No Eyes Sedai. Morgaze's voice was even harder. She fingered her ring again, briefly. She knew that her animosity toward the tower had grown recently beyond what some might say was reasonable, yet she could no longer make herself trust a white tower that seemed to be trying to hide her daughter from her. Her letter to the new Ammerlin demanding Elaine's return — no one demanded anything of an Ammerlin seat, but she had — that letter was yet unanswered. It had barely had time to reach Tar Valon. In any case, she knew for cold fact that she would not have an Aes Sedai near her. And yet, right alongside that, she could not think of Elaine without a swell of pride. Raised accepted after so short a time. Elaine might well be the first woman to sit on the throne of Andor as full Aes Sedai, not just tower-trained. It made no sense that she could feel both things at once, but very little made any sense just now. And her daughter would never have the Lion Throne if Morgaze did not secure it for her. "I said no Aes Sedai, Lini, so you might as well stop looking at me like that. This is one time you will not make me take bad-tasting medicine. Besides which, I doubt if there is an Aes Sedai of any stripe to be found in Camelin. Her old supporters gone, exiled by her own signature, and maybe her enemies for good over what she had done to Alorian. New lords and ladies in their places in the palace, new faces in the guards. What loyalty remained there? Would you recognize a guardsman lieutenant named Talanvor, Lini? At the other woman's quick nod, she went on. Find him for me and bring him here. But do not let him know you are bringing him to me. In fact, tell everyone in the pensioners' quarters that should anyone ask, I am not here. There is more to this than Gabriel and his women, isn't there? Just go, Lini, and hurry. There is not much time. By the shadows she could see in the tree-filled garden through the window, the sun had passed its height. Evening would be there all too soon. Evening, when Gabriel would be looking for her. When Lini left, Morgaze remained in the chair, sitting rigidly. She dared not stand. Her knees were stronger now, but she feared that if she began moving, she would not stop until she was back in her sitting room, waiting for Gabriel. The urge was that strong, especially now that she was alone. And once he looked at her, once he touched her, she had no doubt that she would forgive him everything. Forget everything, maybe, based on how fuzzy and incomplete her memories were. Had she not known better, she could have thought that he had used the one power on her in some way, but no man who could channel survived to his age. Lini had often told her that there was always one man in the world for whom a woman would find herself behaving a brainless fool, but she had never believed that she could succumb. Still, her choices in men had never been good, however right they seemed at the time. Tarangale Damodred she had wed for political reasons. He had been married to Tigraine, the daughter heir whose disappearance had set off the succession when Modrelaine died. Marrying him had made a link with the old queen, smoothing the doubts of most of her opponents, and more importantly had maintained the alliance that had ended the ceaseless wars with Cairhien. In such ways did queens choose their husbands. Tarangale had been a cold, distant man, and there was never love, despite two wonderful children. It had been almost a relief when he died in a hunting accident. Tomdril Merrillin, house-bard and then court-bard, had been a joy at first, intelligent and witty, a laughing man who used the tricks of the game of houses to aid her to the throne and help strengthen Andor once she had it. He had been twice her age then, yet she might have married him. Marriages with commoners were not unheard of in Andor, but he vanished without a word, and her temper got the better of her. She never had learned why he had gone, but it did not matter. When he finally returned, she would surely have rescinded the arrest order, but for once, instead of softly turning her anger aside, he had met her harsh word for harsh word, saying things she could never forgive. Her ears still burned to remember being called a spoiled child and a puppet of Tar Valon. He had actually shaken her, his queen. Then there had been Garth Bryn, strong and capable, as bluff as his face and as stubborn as she. He had turned out to be a treasonous fool. He was well out of her life. It seemed years since she had seen him instead of little more than half of one. And finally, Gabriel, the crown to her list of bad choices. At least the others had not tried to supplant her. Not so many men for one woman's life, but in another way, too many. Another thing that Leni sometimes said was that men were only good for three things, though very good for those. She had been on the throne before Leni had thought her old enough to tell what the three things were. Perhaps if I'd kept just to the dancing, she thought wryly, I'd not have so much trouble with them. The shadows in the garden beyond the window had shifted an hour's worth before Leni returned with young Talonvor, who went to one knee while she was still shutting the door. "He didn't want to come with me at first," she said. 50 years ago, I suppose I could have shown what you are displaying to the world, and he'd have followed quick enough. But now I must needs use sweet reason." Talonvor turned his head to look up at her sourly. "You threatened to harry me here with a stick if I did not come. You are lucky I wondered what was so important to you, instead of having somebody drag you to the infirmary." Her stern sniff did not faze him. His acrid gaze turned angry as it shifted to Morgay's. "I see your meeting with Gabriel did not go well, my queen. I had hoped for more." He was looking straight at her eyes, but Leni's comment had made her aware of her dress again. She felt as though glowing arrows were pointing to her exposed bosom. It was an effort to keep her hands calmly in her lap. "You are a sharp lad, Talonvor, and loyal, I believe, else you would not have come to me with the news of the Two Rivers." "I'm not a boy," he snapped, jerking upright where he knelt. "I am a man who has sworn his life in service to his queen." She let her temper flare right back at him. "If you are a man, behave as one. Stand and answer your queen's questions truthfully. And remember that I am your queen, young Talonvor. Whatever you think may have happened, I am queen of Andor. Forgive me, my queen, I hear and obey." The words were properly said, if not exactly contrite, but he stood head high, staring at her as defiantly as ever. Light! The man was as stubborn as Gareth Bryn had ever been. "How many loyal men are there among the guards in the palace? How many will obey their oaths and follow me?" "I will," he said quietly, and suddenly all of his anger was gone, though he still stared intently at her face. "For the rest, if you wish to find loyal men, you must look to the outlying garrisons, perhaps as far as Whitebridge. Some who were in Camelin were sent to Cairhien with the levies, but the rest in the city are Gabriel's to a man. Their new oath is to throne and law, not the queen." It was worse than she had hoped for, but no more than she had expected, really. Whatever he was, Gabriel was no fool. "Then I must go elsewhere to begin re-establishing my rule. The houses would be difficult to rally after the exiles, after Alorian, but it had to be done. Gabriel may try to stop me leaving the palace." She found a faint memory of trying to leave twice and being halted by Gabriel. "So you will procure 2 horses and wait in the street behind the south stables. I will meet you there, dressed for riding." "Too public," he said, "and too close. Gabriel's men might recognize you, however you disguised yourself. I know a man. Could you find an inn called the Queen's Blessing in the western part of the new city?" The new city was new only in comparison with the inner city it surrounded. "I can." She did not like being opposed, even when it made sense. Bryn had done that, too. It would be a pleasure to show this young man just how well she could disguise herself. It was her habit once a year, though she realized that she had not done it so far this year, to dress as a commoner and walk the streets to feel the pulse of the people. No one had ever recognized her. "But can this man be trusted, young Talonvor?"
"Basil Gill is as loyal to you as I am myself."
He hesitated, anguish crossing his face, then being replaced by anger once more.
"Why have you waited so long? You must have known. You must have seen. Yet you have waited while Gabriel tightened his hands around Andor's neck. Why have you waited?"
So, his anger was honestly come by, and it deserved an honest answer. Only she had no answer, certainly not one she could tell him. "It is not your place to question your queen, young man," she said with a gentle firmness. "A loyal man, as I know that you are loyal, serves without question." He let out a long breath. "I will await you in the stable of the queen's blessing, my queen." And with a bow suitable for a state audience, he was gone. "Why do you keep calling him young?" Linny demanded once the door closed. "It puts his back up. A fool puts a burr under the saddle before she rides."
"He is young, Linny. Young enough to be my son."
Linny snorted, and this time there was nothing delicate about it. "He has a few years on Galad, and Galad is too old to be yours. You were playing with dolls when Talanvor was born, and thinking babes came the same way as dolls." Sighing, Morgaze wondered if the woman had treated her mother like this. Probably. And if Linny lived long enough to see Elaine on the throne, which somehow she did not doubt Linny would last forever, she would probably treat Elaine no differently. That was assuming that a throne remained for Elaine to inherit. "The question is he as loyal as he seems, Linny? One faithful guardsman, when every other loyal man in the palace has been sent away. Suddenly it seems too good to be true." "He swore the new oath." Morgaze opened her mouth, but Linny forestalled her. "I saw him afterwards, alone behind the stables. That's how I knew who you meant. I found out his name. He did not see me. He was on his knees, tears streaming down his face. He alternated apologizing to you and repeating the old oath, not just to the Queen of Andor, but to Queen Morgaze of Andor. He swore in the old way, on his sword, slicing his arm to show he would shed his last drop before breaking it. I know a thing or two of men, girl. That one will follow you against an army with nothing but his bare hands."
That was good to know. If she could not trust him, she would have to doubt Linny next. No, never Linny. He had sworn in the old way? That was something for stories now. And she was letting her thoughts drift again. Surely Gabriel's clouding of her mind was finished now, with all she knew. Then why did a part of her still want to go back to her sitting-room and wait? She had to concentrate. "I will need a simple dress, Linny. One that does not fit too well. A little soot from the fireplace, and..." Linny insisted on coming, too. Morgaze would have had to tie her to a chair to leave her behind, and she was not certain that the old woman would have let herself be tied. She had always seemed frail, and had always been far stronger than she seemed. When they slipped out through a small side gate, Morgaze did not look very much like herself. A bit of soot had darkened her red-gold hair, taken its sheen away and made it lank. Sweat rolling down her face helped as well. No one believed that queens sweated. A shapeless dress of rough, very rough, gray wool with divided skirts completed her disguise. Even her shift and stockings were coarse wool. She looked a farm woman who had ridden the cart horse to market and now wanted to see a little of the city. Linny looked herself, straight-backed and no-nonsense, in a green woolen riding dress, well cut but 10 years out of fashion. Wishing she could scratch, Morgaze also wished that the other woman had not taken her so to heart about the dress not fitting very well. Stuffing the low-necked gown away under the bed, her old nurse had muttered some saying about displaying wares you did not mean to sell, and when Morgaze claimed she had just made it up, her reply was, "At my age, if I make it up, it's still an old saying." Morgaze more than half suspected that her itchy, ill-draped dress was punishment for that gown. The inner city was built on hills, streets following the natural curve of the land and planned to give sudden views of parks full of trees and monuments, or tile-covered towers glittering 100 colors in the sun. Sudden rises hurled the eye across Camelin entire, to the rolling plains and forests beyond. Morgaze saw none of it as she hurried through the crowds thronging the streets. Usually she would have tried to listen to the people, to gauge their mood. This time she heard only the hum and babble of a great city. She had no thought of trying to rouse them.
Thousands of men armed mainly with stones and rage could overwhelm the guards in the royal palace, but if she had not known it before, the riots in the spring that had brought Gabriel to her attention, and the near riots the year before, had shown what mobs could do. She meant to rule again in Camelon, not see it burned. Beyond the white walls of the inner city, the new city had its own beauties. Tall, slender towers and domes gleaming white and gold, huge expanses of red-tiled roofs, and the great towered outer walls, pale gray streaked with silver and white. Broad boulevards, split down the middle by wide expanses of trees and grass, were jammed with people and carriages and wagons. Except to notice in passing that the grass was dying for lack of rain, Morgaze kept her mind on what she was hunting. From the experience of her annual forays, she chose the people she questioned carefully. Men, mostly. She knew how she looked, even with soot in her hair, and some women would give wrong directions from jealousy. Men, on the other hand, racked their brains to be right to impress her. None with too smug a face or too rough. The first were often offended at being approached, as though they were not afoot themselves, and the others were likely to think a woman asking directions had something else on her mind. One fellow, with a chin too big for his face, hawking a tray of pins and needles, grinned at her and said, "Did anyone ever tell you you look a mite like the Queen? Whatever mess she's made of us, she's a pretty one." She gave him a raucous laugh that earned a stern look from Linny. "You save your flattery for your wife. The second turn to the left, you say? I thank you. And for the compliment, too." As she pushed on through the crowd, a frown settled on her face. She had heard too much of that. Not that she looked like the Queen, but that Morgaze had made a mess of things. Gabriel had raised taxes heavily to pay for his levies, it seemed, but she took the blame, and rightly so. The responsibility was the Queen's. Other laws had come out of the palace as well, laws that made little sense but did make people's lives more difficult. She heard whispers about herself, that maybe Andor had had queens long enough. Only murmurs, but what one man dared speak in a low voice, 10 thought. Perhaps it would not have been as easy as she had thought to rouse mobs against Gabriel. Eventually she found her goal, a broad stone inn, the sign over the door bearing a man kneeling before a golden-haired woman in the rose crown, one of her hands on his head, the Queen's blessing. If it was meant to be her, it was not a good likeness. The cheeks were too fat. Not until she stopped in front of the inn did she realize that Leni was puffing. She had set a quick pace, and the woman was far from young. "Leni, I am sorry. I should not have walked so—" "If I can't keep up with you, girl, how will I be able to tend Elaine's babes? Do you mean to stand there? Dragging feet never finish a journey. He said he would be in the stable." The white-haired woman stalked off, muttering to herself, and Morgaze followed her around the inn. Before stepping into the stone stable, she shaded her eyes to look at the sun. No more than 2 hours until dusk. Gabriel would be looking by then if he was not already. Tullinvor was not alone in the stall-lined stable. When he went to one knee on the straw-covered floor in a green wool coat with his sword belted over it, 2 men and a woman knelt with him, if a bit hesitantly, unsure of her as she was. The stout man, pink-faced and balding, must be Basil Gill, the innkeeper. An old leather jerkin studded with steel discs strained around his girth, and he wore a sword at his hip, too.
"My queen," Gill said. "I've not carried a sword in years, not since the Aiel War. But I'd count it an honor if you allowed me to follow you."
He should have looked ridiculous, but he did not. Morgaze studied the other 2, a hulking fellow in a rough gray coat, with heavy-lidded eyes, an oft-broken nose, and scars on his face, and a short, pretty woman approaching her middle years. She seemed to be with the street tough, but her high-necked blue wool dress appeared too finely woven for one like him to have bought. The fellow sensed her doubts for all his lazy-eyed appearance.
"I am Lamgwyn, my queen, and a good queen's man. 'Tisn't right what's been done, and it has to be put straight. I want to follow you, too." Me and Brianna both.
Rise, she told them. It may be some days yet before it is safe for you to acknowledge me as your queen. I will be glad of your company, Master Gil, and yours, Master Lamgwyn. But it will be safer for your woman if she remains in Camelin. There are hard days ahead. Brushing straw from her skirts, Brianna gave her a sharp look, and Leany a sharper. I have known hard days, she said in a Kyrianan accent. Nobly born, unless Morgaze missed her guess, one of the refugees. And I never knew a good man until I found Lamgwyn, or until he found me. The loyalty and love he bears for you I bear for him tenfold. He follows you, but I follow him. I will not stay behind. Morgaze drew breath, then nodded her acceptance. The woman seemed to take it for granted in any case. A fine seed for the army to retake her throne. One young soldier who scowled at her as often as not. A balding innkeeper who looked as if he had not been on a horse in 20 years. A street tough who appeared more than half asleep. And a refugee Kyrian and noble woman who had made it clear that her loyalties went only as far as the tough. And Leany, of course. Leany, who treated her as though she were still in the nursery. Oh, yes, a very fine seed.
Where do we go, my queen? Gil asked as he began leading already saddled horses out of their stalls.
Lamgwyn moved with surprising speed to throw another high-cantled saddle on a horse for Leany. Morgaze realized that she had not considered that. Light, Gabriel can't still be fogging my mind. She still felt that urge to return to her sitting room, though. It was not he. She had had to concentrate on getting out of the palace and reaching here. Once she would have gone to Alorien first, but Pelivar or Arathel would do. Once she had reasoned out how to explain away their exiles. Before she could open her mouth, Talonvor said, "It must be to Gareth Bryn. There is hard feeling against you among the great houses, my queen, but with Bryn following you, they will re-swear allegiance, if only because they know he will win every battle." She clamped her teeth shut to hold back instant refusal. Bryn was a traitor, but he was also one of the finest generals alive. His presence would be a convincing argument when she had to make Pelivar and the rest forget that she had exiled them. Very well. No doubt he would leap at the chance to be captain general of the Queen's Guards once more. And if not, she would manage well enough without him. When the sun touched the horizon, they were 5 miles out of Camelin, and riding hard for Khor Springs.
Night was when Padan Fain felt most comfortable. As he padded through the tapestry-bedecked corridors of the White Tower, it seemed as though the darkness outside made a cloak to hide him from his enemies, despite the stand lamps, gilded and mirrored, burning along his way. A false feeling, he knew. His enemies were many and everywhere. Right that moment, as in every waking hour, he could feel Randall Thor. Not where he was, but that he was still alive. Somewhere. Still alive. It was a gift received at Shael Ghul, in the Pit of Doom, that awareness of Althor. His mind skittered away from memories of what had been done to him in the pit. He had been distilled there. Remade. But later, in Aridhal, he had been reborn. Reborn to smite old enemies and new. He could feel something else as he stalked the empty night hallways of the tower. A thing that was his, stolen from him. A sharper desire drew him at this moment than his longing for Althor's death, or the tower's destruction, or even revenge against his ancient foe. A hunger to be whole. The heavy paneled door had thick hinges and iron straps, and a black iron lock set in it as big as his head. Few doors in the tower were ever locked. Who would dare steal in the midst of Aes Sedai? Yet some things the tower accounted too dangerous to be easily accessible. The most dangerous of all they kept behind this door, guarded by a stout lock. Giggling softly, he took 2 thin, curved metal rods from his coat pocket, inserted them into the keyhole, probing and pressing, twisting. With a slow snap, the bolt came back. For a moment he sagged against the door, laughing hoarsely. guarded by a stout lock. Surrounded by Aes Sedai power, and guarded by simple metal. Even the servants and novices should be done with their chores at this hour, but someone still might be awake, might just wander by. Occasional ripples of mirth still shook him as he replaced the lockpicks in his pocket and took out a fat beeswax candle, lighting the wick at a nearby stand lamp. He held the candle high as he closed the door behind him, peering around. Shelves lined the wall, holding plain boxes and inlaid chests of various sizes and shapes. Small figures in bone or ivory, or darker material. Things of metal and glass and crystal that sparkled in the candlelight. Nothing that appeared dangerous. Dust covered everything. Even the Aes Sedai came here seldom, and they allowed no one else in. What he was seeking pulled him to it. On a waist-high shelf stood a dark metal box. He opened it, revealing lead walls 2 inches thick, with just enough space inside for a curved dagger in a golden sheath, a large ruby set in its hilt. Neither the gold nor the ruby, glittering dark as blood, interested him. Hastily, he spilled a little wax to hold the candle beside the box and snatched up the dagger. He sighed as soon as he touched it, stretched languorously. He was whole again, one with what had bound him so long ago, one with what, in a very real way, had given him life. Iron hinges creaked faintly, and he darted for the door, bearing the curved blade. The pale young woman opening the door had only time to gape, to try to leap back before he slashed her cheek. In the same motion, he dropped the sheath and seized her arm, jerked her past him into the storeroom. Putting his head out, he peered up and down the hallway. Still empty. He took his time about pulling his head back and shutting the door again. He knew what he would find. The young woman lay thrashing on the stone floor, trying and failing to scream. Her hands clawed at a face already black and bloated beyond recognition, the dark swelling oozing down onto her shoulders like thick oil. Her snowy skirts, banded in colors at the hem, flailed as her feet scrabbled uselessly. He licked at a splash of blood on his hand and giggled as he picked up the sheath. "You are a fool." He spun, dagger reaching, but the air around him seemed to turn solid, encasing him from his neck to the sole of his boots. He hung there, on the balls of his feet, dagger extended to stab, staring at Alviarin as she shut the door behind her and leaned against it to study him. There had been no creak this time. The soft scraping of the dying girl's slippers in the floorstones could never have masked it. He blinked away sweat that was suddenly stinging his eyes. "Did you really think," the Aes Sedai went on, "that there would be no guard on this room, no watch kept? A ward was set on that lock. That young fool's task tonight was to monitor it. Had she done as she was supposed to, you would find a dozen warders and as many Aes Sedai outside this door now. She is paying the price of her stupidity." The thrashing behind him stilled and his eyes narrowed. Alviarin was not Yellow Aja, but even so, she could have made an attempt to heal the young woman. And she had not raised the alarm the accepted should have either, or she would not now be here alone.
"You are Black Aja," he whispered.
"A dangerous accusation," she said calmly. It was not clear to which of them it was dangerous. "Swan Sanjay tried to claim the Black Aja was real when she was under the question. She begged to tell us of them. Elida would not hear it. And will not. Tales of the Black Aja are a vile slander against the tower."
"You are Black Aja," he said in a louder voice.
"You want to steal that?" She sounded as though he had not spoken. "The ruby is not worth it, Fane, or whatever your name is. That blade is tainted so none but a fool would touch it except with tongs, or be near it for a moment longer than necessary. You can see what it did to Varin. So why did you come here, and go straight to what you should not have known was here? You cannot have had time for any search."
I can dispose of Elida for you. One touch of this, and even healing will not save her.
He tried to gesture with the dagger, but could not budge it a hair. If he could have moved it, Alviarin would be dead by now.
You could be first in the tower, not second.
She laughed at him, cool, contemptuous chimes.
Do you think I would not be first if I had wished it? Second suits me. Let Elida claim credit for what she calls successes, and sweat for her failures, too. I know where the power lies. Now answer my questions, or two corpses will be found here in the morning instead of one.
There would be two in any case, whether he answered her with suitable lies or not. She did not mean to let him live.
I have seen Thakandar.
Saying that hurt. The memories it brought were agony. He refused to whimper, forced the words out.
The great sea of fog, rolling and crashing in silence against the black cliffs. The fires of the forges glowing red beneath. And the lightning stabbing up into a sky fit to drive men mad.
He did not want to go on, but he made himself.
I have taken the path down to the belly of Sheol Ghul, down the long way with stones like fangs brushing my head, to the shore of a lake of fire and molten rock. No, not again. That holds the great Lord of the Dark in its endless depths. The heavens above Sheol Ghul are black at noon with his breath.
Alviarin was standing upright now, eyes wide. Not fearful, but impressed.
I have heard of...
She began softly, then shook herself and stared at him piercingly.
Who are you? Why are you here?
Did one of the Chosen send you? Why was I not informed?
He threw back his head and laughed.
Are the tasks given to the likes of me for the likes of you to be knowing?
The accents of his native Lugard were strong again. In a way, it was his native city.
Do the Chosen confide everything in you, then?
Something inside seemed to shout that this was not the way, but he hated Aes Sedai, and that something inside him did, too.
Be careful, pretty little Aes Sedai, or they'll be giving you to a murderer for its sport.
Her glare was icicles stabbing his eyes.
We shall see, Master Fane.
I will clear away this mess you have made, and then we shall see which of us stands higher with the Chosen.
Eyeing the dagger, she backed from the room. The air around him did not soften until she had been gone a full minute. Silently, he snarled at himself.
Fool, playing the Aes Sedai's game, groveling for them, and then one moment of anger to ruin all.
Sheathing the dagger, he nicked himself and licked the wound before sticking the weapon under his coat. He was not at all what she thought. He had been a dark friend once, but he was beyond that now. Beyond it, above it. Something different. Something more.
If she managed to communicate with one of the Forsaken before he could dispose of her,
better not to try. No time to find the Horn of Alir now. There were followers awaiting him outside the city. They should still be waiting. He had put fear into them. He hoped some of the humans were still alive. Before the sun rose, he was out of the tower, off the island of Tarvalin.
Althor was out there. Somewhere. And he was whole again.
Chapter 20. Jengai Pass. Under the looming spine of the world, Rand guided Jiaden up the stony slope from the foothills that began the foot of Jengai Pass. The dragon wall pierced the sky, dwarfing all other mountains, its snow-capped peaks defying the baking afternoon sun. The tallest thrust well above the clouds that mocked the waste with promises of rain that had never come. Rand could not imagine why a man would want to climb a mountain, but it was said that men who had tried to scale these heights turned back, overcome with fear, and unable to breathe. He could well believe that a man might grow too afraid to breathe, attempting to climb so high.
"Yet though the Kyrianen are consumed with the game of houses," Moraine was saying at his shoulder, "they will follow you so long as they know that you are strong. Be firm with them, but I would ask you to be fair also. A ruler who gives true justice."
He tried to ignore her, as he did the other riders, and the creak and rumble of Kadir's wagons, making heavy going further back. The broken gorges and gullies of the waste were behind them, but these rugged rising hills, nearly as barren, were little better for wagons. No one had traveled this path in over 20 years. Moraine talked at him that way from daybreak to sunset whenever he let her. Her lectures could be on small things, details of court behavior, say, in Kyrian or Saldaea or somewhere else, or on large, the political influence of the White Cloaks, or perhaps the effects of trade on rulers' decisions to go to war. It was as if she meant to see him educated, as a noble would be, or should be, before he reached the other side of the mountains. It was surprising how often what she said reflected what anyone back in Emmons Field would have called simple common sense, and also how often it did not. Occasionally she came out with something startling. For instance, that he should trust no woman of the Tower except herself, Egwene, Elaine, and Nynaeve, or the news that Elida was now the Amarlin seat. Oath to obey or no, she would not tell him how she knew that. She said it was someone else's place to tell if she chose, someone else's secret, and she could not usurp it. He suspected the Wise One dreamwalkers, though they had stared him right in the eye and refused to say aye or nay. He wished he could make them swear Moraine's oath. They interfered between him and the chiefs continually, as if they wanted him to go through them to reach the chiefs. Right that minute, he did not want to think about Elida or the Wise Ones or listen to Moraine. Now he wanted to study the pass ahead, a deep gap in the mountains that twisted as though a blunt axe had tried to chop through again and again, never quite succeeding. A few minutes' hard ride, and he could be in it. On one side of the pass mouth, a sheer cliff had been smoothed over 100 pace width and carved, a wind-weathered snake entwining a staff a good 300 spans high. Monument or marker or ruler's sigil, it surely dated from some lost nation before Arthur Hawkwing, perhaps even before the Trolloc Wars. He had seen remnants before from nations long vanished. Often even Moiraine did not know their source. High on the other side, so far up that he was not sure he was seeing what he thought, just below the snow line, stood something even stranger. Something that made the first monument of a few thousand years a commonplace. He could have sworn it was the remnants of shattered buildings, shining gray against the darker mountain, and stranger still, what appeared to be a dock of the same material as for ships, slanting drunkenly down the mountain. If he was not imagining it, that had to date from before the breaking. The face of the world had been changed utterly in those years. This could well have been an ocean's floor before. He would have to ask Asmodian. Even if he had had the time, he did not think he would want to try reaching that altitude to find out for himself. At the foot of the huge snake lay Tyon, a high-walled town of moderate size, a remnant itself of the time when Kyrian had been allowed to send caravans across the threefold land, and wealth had flowed from Shara along the Silk Path. There appeared to be birds above the town, and dark blotches at regular intervals along the gray stone walls. Matt stood in Pips's stirrups, shading his eyes with that broad-brimmed hat to peer up the pass, frowning. Lan's hard face wore no expression at all, yet he appeared just as intent. A gust of wind, a little cooler here, whipped his color-shifting cloak around him, and for a moment all of him from shoulders to boots seemed to blend into the rocky hills and sparse thorn bushes.
"Are you listening to me?" Moraine said suddenly, reining her white mare closer. "You must!"
She took a deep breath.
"Please, Rand, there is so much that I must tell you, so much that you need to know.
The hint of pleading in her tone made him glance at her. He could remember when he had been overawed by her presence. Now she seemed quite small, for all her regal manner. A fool thing that he should feel protective of her.
"There is plenty of time ahead of us, Maureen," he said gently. "I don't pretend to think I know as much of the world as you. I mean to keep you close from now on."
He barely realized how great a change that was from when she was keeping him close.
"But I have something else in my mind right now."
"Of course," she sighed, "as you wish. We have plenty of time yet."
Rand heeled the dappled gray stallion to a trot, and the others followed.
The wagons quickened, too, though they could not keep up on the slope. Asmodeans, Jason the Tails, patch-covered Gleeman's cloak, rippled behind him like the banner he carried at his stirrup, brilliant red with the white and black symbol of the ancient Aes Sedai at its center. His face wore a sullen glower. He had not been best pleased at having to be the bannerman. Under that sign, he would conquer, the prophecy of Roydian said, and perhaps it would not frighten the world so much as the dragon banner, Luz Theron's banner, that he had left flying over the Stone of Tyr. Few would know this sign. The blotches on the walls of Tyan were bodies, contorted in their final agonies, bloated in the sun and hanging by their necks in a row that seemed to encircle the town. The birds were glossy black ravens and vultures with their heads and necks befouled. Some ravens perched on corpses, gorging, unconcerned for the new arrivals. The sickly sweet stench of corruption hung in the dry air, and the acrid smell of char. Iron-strapped gates stood gaping open on an expanse of ruin, soot-streaked stone houses, and collapsed roofs. Nothing moved except the birds.
"Like Marua."
He tried to shake the thought away, but in his head he could see that great city after it was retaken, immense towers blackened and collapsing, the remains of great bonfires at every street crossing, where those who had refused to swear to the shadow had been bound and thrown alive to the flames. He knew whose memory it had to be, though he had not discussed it with Moraine.
"I am Randall Thor. Luz Theron Telamon is dead 3,000 years. I am myself."
That was one battle he meant to win. If he did have to die at Shael Ghul, he would die as himself. He made himself think of something else. Half a month since he had left Rhydion. Half a month, though the Aiel had set a pace afoot from sunup to sundown that wearied the horses. But Cooladin had been moving this way a week before he learned of it. If they had not managed to close any ground, he would have that long to ravage Kyrian before Rand could reach it. Longer before the Shidel could be brought to bay. Not a much happier thought.
"There's someone watching us from those rocks to the left," Lan said quietly. He seemed to be completely engrossed in studying what remained of Tyan. "Not Aiel, or I doubt I would have seen a glimmer."
Rand was glad that he had made Egwene and Avienda stay with the Wise Ones. The town gave him a new reason, but the Watcher fit in with his original plan, when he had hoped that Tyan had escaped. Egwene still wore the same Aiel clothes as Avienda, and Aiel would not have been very welcome in Tyan. They were even less likely to be welcome among the survivors. He looked back at the wagons, drawing to a halt a short distance downslope. Mutters drifted up from the drivers, now that they could see the town clearly, and the walls' decorations. Kadir, his bulk all in white again today, mopped at his hawk-nosed face with a large kerchief. He appeared unperturbed, merely pursing his lips thoughtfully. Rand expected that Moraine would have to find new drivers once they were through the pass. Kadir and his crew would likely flee as soon as they had the chance. And he would have to let them go. It was not right. It was not justice. But it was necessary to protect Asmodian. How long now had he been doing what was necessary instead of what was right? In a fair world, they would be one and the same. That made him laugh, a hoarse wheeze. He was far from the village boy he had been, but sometimes that boy sneaked up on him. The others looked at him, and he fought the urge to tell them that he was not mad yet. Long minutes passed before two coatless men and a woman emerged from the rocks, all three ragged and dirty and barefoot. They approached hesitantly, heads tilted uneasily, eyes darting from rider to rider, to the wagons and back, as though they might take flight at a shout. Gaunt cheeks and wavering steps spoke of hunger.
"Thank the light,"
one of the men said finally. He was gray-haired. None of the three was young. His face deeply creased. His eyes lingered a moment on Asmodian, with falls of lace at collar and cuffs, but the leader of this train would not be riding a mule and carrying a banner. It was Rand's stirrup that he clutched anxiously.
"A light be praised that you came out of those terrible lands alive, my lord."
That might have been Rand's blue silk coat embroidered in gold in the shoulders, or the banner, or simple flattery. The man certainly had no reason to think them other than merchants, if well dressed for it.
"Those murdering savages have risen again. It is another Aiel war. They were over the wall in the night before anybody knew, killing everyone who raised a hand, stealing everything not mortared in place."
"In the night," Matt said sharply. Hat pulled low, he was still studying the ruined town.
"Were your sentries asleep? You did have sentries this close to your enemies. Even Aiel would have a hard time coming at you if you kept a good watch."
Land gave him an appraising look.
"No, my lord."
The gray-haired man blinked at Matt, then gave his answer to Rand. Matt's green coat was fine enough for a lord, but it hung open and looked slept in.
We had only a watchman at each gate. It has been long since any have even seen one of the savages. But this time, whatever they did not steal, they burned, and drove us out to starve. Filthy animals! Thank the light you have come to save us, my lord, or we would all have died here. I am Talnethan. I was a saddle maker. A good one, my lord. This is my sister Aril, and her husband, Under Coral. He makes fine boots.
They stole people too, my lord,
the woman said, her voice raw. Somewhat younger than her brother, she might have been handsome once, but haggard worry had etched lines in her face that Rand suspected would never entirely go away. Her husband had a lost look in his eyes, as if not exactly sure where he was.
My daughter, my lord, and my son. They took all the young ones, everyone above 16, and some twice that or more. Said they were guy something, and stripped them naked right in the street and herded them off. My lord, can you?
She trailed off, eyes squeezing shut as the impossibility overwhelmed her, swaying. Small odds that she would ever see her children again. Moraine was out of her saddle in an instant, and by Aril's side. The haggard woman gave a loud gasp as soon as the Aes Sedai's hands touched her, shivering to her toe-tips. Her wondering look turned to Moraine questioningly, but Moraine only held her as if supporting her. The woman's husband suddenly gaped, staring at Rand's gilded belt buckle, the gift from Avienda.
"His arms were marked like that, all twined around, like the cliff snake."
Tal looked up at Rand uncertainly.
"The savage's leader, my lord. He had markings like that on his arms. He wore those strange clothes they all do, but he had his coat sleeves cut off, and he made sure everybody saw."
"A gift I received in the waste," Rand said. He made sure to keep his hands still on his pommel. His coat sleeves hid his own dragons, except for the heads. They would be visible on the backs of his hands to anyone who looked closely. Aril had forgotten about wondering what Moraine had actually done, and all three looked on the point of running. "How long since they left?"
6 days, my lord," Tal said uneasily. "They did what they did in a night and a day, and were gone the next. We would have gone too, but what if we met them coming back? Surely they would turn back at Selene?"
That was the town at the other end of the pass. Rand doubted that Selene was in any better condition than Tyen by this time. "How many survivors are there besides you three?"
"Maybe 100, my lord. Maybe more. Nobody has counted."
Abruptly, anger flared in him, though he tried to hold it down. 100 of you. His voice was icy iron. And 6 days. Then why are your dead left for the ravens? Why do corpses still decorate your town walls? Those are your people filling your nostrils with their stink. Huddling together, the three backed away from his horse.
We were afraid, my lord,
Tal said hoarsely.
They went, but they could come back. And he told us, the one with the markings on his arms, told us not to touch anything. A message,
Anders said in a dull voice.
He chose them out to hang, just pulling them out until he had enough to line the wall. Men, women, he did not care.
His eyes were fixed on Rand's buckle.
He said they were a message for some man who would be following him. He said he wanted this man to know. Know what they were going to do on the other side of the spine. He said he would do worse to this man.
Arl's eyes widened suddenly, and the three stared beyond Rand for a moment, gaping. Then, screaming, they turned and ran. Black-veiled Aiel rose from the rocks they had come from, and they darted off in another direction. Veiled Aiel appeared there, too, and they collapsed to the ground, sobbing and holding each other as they were surrounded. Moraine's face was cool and composed, but her eyes were not serene. Rand twisted in his saddle. Ruark and Derek were coming up the slope, unveiling themselves and unwrapping the shufa from around their heads. Derek was thicker than Ruark, with a prominent nose and paler streaks through his golden hair. He had brought the rain, Aiel, as Ruark said he would. Timolin and his Mia Goma had been paralleling them to the north for 3 days, exchanging occasional messengers but giving no clue to his intentions. The Kodara and the Shianda and the Darin were still somewhere to the east. Following, so Amis and the others said, from dream talking to their wise ones, but slowly. Those wise ones had no more idea of their clan chief's aims than Rand did of Timolin's. Was that necessary? He said as the two chiefs came up to him. He had frightened the people first, but for cause, and had not made them think that they were going to die. Ruark simply shrugged, and Derek said, We put spears in place around this hold unseen as you wished, and there seemed no reason to wait since no one remained here to dance spears. Besides, they are only tree killers. Rand drew a deep breath. He had known this might be as large a problem as Culloden in its own way. Nearly 500 years ago, the Aiel had presented Kyrian with a sapling, a cutting from Avan de Sora, and with it, a right granted to no other nation, to trade across the threefold land to Shara. They had given no reason. They did not like wetlanders very much at the best. But to the Aiel, it had been required by Jieto. During the long years of journey that had brought them to the waste, only one people had not attacked them. Only one had allowed them water uncontested when the world grew parched. And finally they had found the descendants of those people, the Kyrianin. For 500 years riches had flowed into Kyrian with the silk and the ivory. 500 years, and Avendor Aldera grew in Kyrian. And then King Laemon had cut the tree down to make a throne. The nations knew why the Aiel had crossed the spine of the world 20 years ago. Laemon's sin, they called it, and Laemon's pride. But few knew that to the Aiel, it had not been a war. 4 clans had come to find an oathbreaker, and when they had killed him, they returned to the threefold land. But their contempt for the tree killers, the oathbreakers, had never died. Moraine being Aes Sedai offset her being Kyrianin, but Rand was never sure how much. These folk broke no oaths, he told them. Find the others. The saddlemaker says there are about 100, and be gentle with them. If any of them were watching, they're probably running away into the mountains by now. The two Aiel started to turn away, and he added, Do you hear what they told me? What do you think of what Culloden did here?
They killed more than they had to, Derek said with a disgusted shake of his head. Like black ferrets falling on rock hens' nests in a gully.
Killing was as easy as dying, so the Aiel said. Any fool could do either. And the other thing, taking prisoners? Gaishain? Ruark and Derek exchanged looks, and Derek's mouth tightened. Clearly they had heard, and it made them uncomfortable. It took a great deal to make an Aiel uncomfortable.
It cannot be so, Ruark said at last. If it is, Gaishain is a thing of Jieto. No one can be made Gaishain who does not follow Jieto, else they are only human animals, such as the Sharans keep. Culloden has abandoned Jieto.
Derek sounded as though he were saying stones had grown wings. Matt guided Pips closer, using his knees. He had never been more than an indifferent rider, but sometimes, when he was thinking of something else, he rode as though born on a horse's back.
That surprises you, he said. After everything he has done already, the man would cheat at dice with his mother.
They gave him flat-eyed stares, like blue stones. In many ways, Aiel were Jieto. And whatever else Culloden was, he was still Aiel in their eyes. Sept before clan, clan before outsiders, but Aiel before wetlanders. Some of the maidens joined them, Anila and Jolene and Adeline, and wiry white-haired Sulin, who had been chosen roof mistress of the Roof of the Maidens in Ruidion. She had told the maidens who stayed to choose another, and now she led the maidens here. They sensed the mood and said nothing, only grounded their spear points patiently. An Aiel who wanted to could make the rocks look hasty. Lan broke the silence.
If Culloden expects you to be following him, he may have left a surprise somewhere in the pass. 100 men could hold some of those narrows against an army. 1,000?
We will camp here, then, Rand said. And send scouts ahead to make sure the way is clear.
Duada Madiin?
Water seekers, Derek agreed, sounding pleased. That had been his society before he became clan chief. Sulin and the other maidens gave Rand flat stares as the rain chief walked away downslope. He had chosen scouts from other societies for the last 3 days when he had begun to fear what he might find here, and he had the feeling they knew he was not just giving the others their turns. He tried to ignore their looks. Sulin's was especially difficult. The woman could have driven nails with those pale blue eyes.
Ruark, once the survivors are found, see that they're fed and well-treated. We will take them with us.
His gaze was drawn to the town wall. Some Aiel were already using their curved horn bows to kill ravens. Sometimes Shadowspawn used ravens and other animals that fed on death as spies. Shadow eyes, the Aiel called them. These barely paused in the frenzied feeding until they fell transfixed with an arrow. But a wise man did not take chances with ravens or rats.
And see that the dead are buried.
At least in that, right and necessity were the same. Chapter 21 The Gift of a Blade. The camp began to go up quickly, in the mouth of Jangai Pass, if away from Tyon, and spreading over the hills around the approaches, and among the scattered thorn bushes, and even under the slopes of the mountains. Not that anything was very visible except what was inside the pass. Aiel tents blended into the stony soil so well that you could miss them, even when you knew what you were looking for and where. In the hills, the Aiel camped by clan, but those in the pass itself grouped themselves by society. They were mostly maidens, but the men's societies sent their representatives too, some 50 each, spreading tents well above the ruins of Dian in slightly separated camps. Everyone understood, or thought they did, about the maidens carrying Rand's honor, but all societies wanted to guard the Kara Karn. Moiraine, and Lan, of course, went to get Kadir's wagons settled just below the town. The Aes Sedai fussed over what was in those wagons nearly as much as she did over Rand. The drivers muttered and cursed about the town's smell and avoided watching the Aiel cut bodies down from the wall. But after their months in the waste, they seemed to like being close even to the wreckage of what they saw as civilization. Guy Shine were wrecking the Wise Ones' tents, those of Amis and Bear and Malayne, below the town, astride the faded track that led up out of the hills. Rand was sure they would say they had chosen the spot to be available to him, as well as to the countless dozens of Wise Ones below, but he thought it no coincidence that anyone coming up from the hills to him would have to go through or around their camp to reach him. He was a little surprised to see Malayne directing the white-robed figures. Only 3 nights before, she had married Bale, in a ceremony that made her his wife and first sister to his other wife, Dorinda. That part had been just as important as the marriage, apparently. Avienda had been shocked at his surprise, or maybe angry. When Egwene arrived with Avienda up behind her on the gray mare, those full skirts pushed above their knees, they looked a matched pair despite their different coloring, and Avienda being tall enough to look over Egwene's shoulder without stretching, each with just one ivory bracelet and one necklace. The work of removing the hanged corpses had barely begun. Most of the ravens lay dead, bundles of black feathers littering the ground, and the rest had flown. But vultures, too gorged to flap aloft, still waddled through the ashes inside the walls. Rand wished that there was some way he could keep the two women from having to see, but to his surprise, neither went running to empty her stomach. Well, he had not really expected anything of the sort from Avienda. She had seen death often enough, and dealt it out, too, and her face remained expressionless. But he had not expected the pure pity in Egwene's eyes as she gazed at the bloated dead coming down. She drew Mist over to Jotun and leaned to put a hand on his arm.
"I am so sorry, Rand. There was no way you could have stopped this."
"I know," he told her. He had not even known there was a town here until Ruark mentioned it casually 5 days ago. His councils with the chiefs had all been on whether they could cover more ground in a day, and what Culloden would do when he cleared the Jangai. And by that time, the Shido had finished here and gone. He had done with cursing himself for a fool then.
"Well, just you remember it. It was not your fault."
She healed Mist on and began talking to Avienda before she was out of earshot.
"I'm glad he is taking it so well. He has the habit of feeling guilty over things he cannot control." "Men always believe they are in control of everything around them," Avienda replied. "When they find out they are not, they think they have failed, instead of learning a simple truth women already know."
Egwene giggled.
"That is the simple truth. Once I saw those poor people, I thought we would find him heaving somewhere. Is his stomach so tender?
Their voices faded away as the mare ambled on. Rand pulled himself back upright in the saddle, flushing. Trying to eavesdrop on them. He was behaving like an idiot. That did not stop him frowning at their departing backs. He only took responsibility for what he was accountable for, if only to himself. Just for things he could do something about. And what he should have done something about. He did not like them talking about him, behind his back or under his nose. The light only knew what they were saying. Dismounting, he led Jotun in search of Osmodian, who seemed to have wandered off. After so many days in the saddle, it was good to walk. Various clusters of tents were springing up along the pass. The mountain slopes and cliffs made formidable barriers, but the Aiel still arranged themselves as if they could expect attack from them. He had tried walking with the Aiel, but half a day was enough to put him back on the horse. It was hard enough to keep up with him mounted. They could wear out horses when they pressed. Matt was down, too, squatting with his reins in one hand and that black hafted spear across his knees, peering at the gaping gates, studying the town and muttering to himself while Pips tried to nibble at a thorn bush. Matt was studying, not just staring. Where had that remark about sentries come from? Matt said odd things at times now, since their first visit to Rudion. Rand wished that he were willing to talk about what had happened, but he still denied that anything had, despite the foxhead medallion, the spear, and that scar around his neck. Melindra, the Shido maiden that Matt had taken up with, was off to one side watching Matt, until Sulan came and chased her away on some errand. Rand wondered if Matt knew the maidens were laying bets on whether Melindra would give up the spear for him, and on whether she would teach him to sing, too, though they only laughed when Rand asked what that meant. The sound of music drew him to Osmodian, seated by himself on a granite outcrop with his harp on his knee. The Crimson Banner's staff had been twisted into the rocky soil, and the mule tethered to it.
"You see, my lord dragon," he said cheerfully, "your bannerman keeps loyally to his duties."
His voice and expression changed, and he said,
"If you must have this thing, why not let Matt carry it, or Lan, or Moraine, for that matter? She would be glad to carry your banner and clean your boots."
"Be careful of her. She is a devious woman.
When a woman says she will obey you of her own will, it is time to sleep lightly and watch your back."
"You carry it because you were chosen, Master Jason Natale." Osmodian gave a start and looked around, though everyone else was too far away and too busy to be listening. None but they, too, would have understood anyway. "What do you know about those ruins up near the snow line? They must come from the Age of Legends." Osmodian did not even glance up the mountain.
"This world is very changed from the world I went to sleep in."
He sounded weary, and he shivered slightly.
"What I know of what lies where, I have learned since waking."
The mournful sounds of the March of Death rose from his harp. "That could be what is left of the city where I was born, for all I know. Shorel was a port." The sun had maybe an hour before the spine of the world hit it. This close to high mountains, night came early.
"I am too tired for one of our discussions tonight."
That was what they called Osmodian's lessons in public, even when no one was around. Added to practice sessions with Lan O'Ruach, those lessons had left him little time for sleep since leaving Rudion.
"You take to your tent when you're ready, and I'll see you in the morning, with the banner."
There was no one else to carry the bloody thing. Maybe he could find somebody in Kyrian. As he was turning away, Osmodian plucked something discordant and said,
"No burning nets woven around my tent tonight. Do you finally begin to trust me?"
Rand looked back over his shoulder.
"I trust you like a brother, until the day you betray me."
"You have a parole for what you've done, in return for your teaching, and a better bargain than you deserve. But the day you turn against me, I will tear it up and bury it with you."
Osmodian opened his mouth, but Rand forestalled him.
"That is me talking, Natale. Randall Thor.
Two Rivers folk don't like people who try to stab them in the back."
Irritably, he pulled at the Dapple's reins and went on before the other man could say anything. He was not sure whether Osmodian had any inkling that a dead man was trying to take him over, but he should not have let himself give the man hints. Osmodian was sure enough already that he was a helpless cause. If he began to think that Rand was not in full control of his own mind, perhaps that he was going mad, the Forsaken would abandon him in a heartbeat, and there was too much Rand had to learn yet. White-robed Guy Shine were erecting his tent under Avienda's direction, well into the pass mouth, with that huge carved snake rearing above. The Guy Shine had their own tents, but those would be the last erected, of course. Adeline and a dozen or so maidens squatted nearby, watching, waiting to guard his sleep. Even with over 1,000 maidens encamped around him every night, they still put a guard on his tent. Before approaching, he reached out through the Angreal in his coat pocket to see Saidin. There was no need to actually touch the carving of the fat little man with a sword, of course. Mingled filth and sweetness filled him, that raging river of fire, that crushing avalanche of ice. Channeling as he had done every night since leaving Rudion, he set wards around the entire encampment, not only what was in the pass, but every tent in the hills below as well, and on the slopes of the mountains. He needed the Angreal to set warding so large, but only just. He had thought that he was strong before, but Osmodian's teaching were making him stronger. No human or animal crossing the line of that ward would notice anything, but Shadow Spawn that touched it would sound a warning that everyone in the tents would hear. Had he done this in Rudion, the Darkhounds could never have entered without him knowing. The Aiel themselves would have to keep watch for human enemies. Wardings were complex weaves, if tenuous, and trying to make them do more than one thing could render them useless in practicality. He could have made this one to kill Shadowspawn instead of merely giving warning, but that would have been like a beacon to any male Forsaken who might be searching, and to Murdral, too. No need to bring his enemies down on him when they might not know where he was. This, even one of the Forsaken would not know until he was close, and a Murdral not until it was too late. Letting go of Sidene was an exercise in self-control, despite the foulness of the taint, despite the way the power tried to scour him away like sand on a riverbed, to burn him, obliterate him. He floated in the vast emptiness of the void, yet he could feel the air stirring against each hair on his head, see the weave of the Gaishine's robes, smell Avienda's warm scent. He wanted more. But he could smell the ashes of Tyan, too. Smell the dead who had been burned, the corruption of those who had not. Even the ones already burned, mingled with the dry soil of their graves. That helped. For a while after Sidene was gone, all he did was take deep breaths of hot, arid air. Compared to before, the whiff of death seemed absent, and the air itself pure and wonderful. "Look what was here before us," Avienda said, as he let a meek-faced, white-robed woman take Jiaden. She held up a brown snake, dead, but as thick as his forearm, and nearly 3 paces long. The blood snake took its name from the effect of its bite, turning the blood to jelly in minutes. Unless he missed his guess, the neat wound behind its head had come from her belt knife. Adeline and the other maidens looked approving. "Did you ever for 1 minute think that it could have bitten you?" he said. "Did you ever think of using the power instead of a bloody belt knife? Why didn't you kiss it first? You had to be close enough." She drew herself up, and her big green eyes should have brought on the night's chill early. "The wise ones say it is not good to use the power too often." The clipped words were as cold as her eyes. "They say it is possible to draw too much and harm yourself." Frowning slightly, she added, more to herself than him, "Though I have not come near what I can hold yet, I am sure of it." Shaking his head, he ducked into the tent. The woman would not listen to reason. No sooner had he settled himself against a silk cushion near the still unlit fire than she followed him. Without the blood snake, thankfully, but gingerly carrying something long, wrapped in thick layers of gray-striped blanket. "You were worried for me," she said in a flat voice. There was no expression at all on her face. "Of course not," he lied. "Fool woman. She'll get herself killed yet because she doesn't have the sense to be careful when it's needed. I'd have been as worried for anyone. I would not want anyone bitten by a blood snake." For a moment, she eyed him doubtfully, then gave a quick nod. "Good. So long as you do not presume toward me." Tossing the bundled blanket at his feet, she sat on her heels across the fire pit from him. "You would not accept the buckle as canceling debt between us. Avienda, there is no debt." He thought that she had forgotten about that. She went on as if he had not spoken. "But perhaps that will cancel it." Sighing, he unwrapped the striped blanket. Warily, since she had held it far more uneasily than she had the snake. She had held the bloody snake as if it were a piece of cloth. Unwrapped it, and gasped. What lay inside was a sword, the scabbard so encrusted with rubies and moondrops that it was hard to see the gold except where a rising sun of many rays had been inset. The ivory hilt, long enough for two hands, had another inlaid rising sun in gold. The pommel was thick with rubies and moondrops, and still more made a solid mass along the quillens. This had never been made to use, only to be seen, to be stared at. "This must have cost..." "Avienda, how could you pay for it?"
"It cost little," she said, so defensively that she might as well have added that she lied. A sword? How did you ever come by a sword? How did any Aiel come by a sword? Don't tell me Kadir had this hidden in his wagons.
I carried it in a blanket. She sounded even more touchy now than she had about the price. Even Bear said that would make it all right, so long as I did not actually touch it.
She shrugged uncomfortably, shifting and reshifting her shawl.
It was the tree killer's sword, Layman's. It was taken from his body as proof that he was dead, because his head could not be brought back so far. Since then it has passed from hand to hand, young men or fool maidens who wanted to own the proof of his death. Only each began to think of what it was, and soon sold it to another fool. The price has come down very far since it was first sold. No Aiel would lay hand to it, even to remove the stones.
Well, it is very beautiful, he said, as tactfully as he could manage. Only a buffoon would carry something this gaudy, and that ivory hilt would twist in a hand slippery with sweat or blood. But I cannot let you... He trailed off as he bared a few inches of the blade, out of habit, to examine the edge. Etched into the shining steel stood a heron, symbol of a blade master. He had carried a sword marked like that once. Suddenly he was ready to bet that this blade was like it, like the raven-marked blade on Matt's spear. Metal made with power that would never break and never need sharpening. Most blade masters' swords were only copies of those. Lan could tell him for certain, but he was sure already in his own mind. Pulling the scabbard off, he leaned across the fire pit to place it in front of her. I will take the blade to cancel the debt, Avienda. It was long and slightly curved with a single edge. Just the blade. You can have the hilt back, too. He could have a new hilt and scabbard made in Kyrian. Maybe one of Tayan's survivors was a decent bladesmith. She stared wide-eyed from the scabbard to him and back, mouth open, stunned for the first time that he had ever seen.
But those gems are worth much, much more than I... You are trying to put me in your debt again, Randall Thor.
Not so. If this blade had lain untouched and untarnished in its scabbard for over 20 years, it had to be what he thought. I did not accept the scabbard, so it has been yours all along. Tossing one of the silk cushions into the air, he executed the seated version of the form called Low Wind Rising. Feathers rained down as the blade sliced neatly through. And I don't accept the hilt either, so that's yours too. If you have made a profit, it is your own doing. Instead of looking happy at her good fortune, he suspected she had given everything that she had for the sword, and likely gotten back 100 times as much or more in the scabbard alone. Instead of seeming glad or thanking him, she glared through the feathers as indignantly as any good wife in the Two Rivers, seeing her floor littered. Stiffly, she clapped, and one of the Gaishine appeared, immediately going to her knees to begin cleaning up the mess. "It is my tent," he said pointedly. Avienda sniffed at him in perfect imitation of Egwene. Those two women were definitely spending too much time together. Supper, when it came at full dark, consisted of the usual flat pale bread and a spicy stew of dried peppers and beans with chunks of nearly white meat. He only grinned at her when he learned that it was the blood snake. He had eaten snake, and worse, since coming to the waste. Gara, the poisonous lizard, was the worst in his estimation, not for the taste, which was rather like chicken, but because it was lizard. It sometimes seemed that there must be more poisonous things, snakes, lizards, spiders, plants, in the waste, than in the rest of the world combined. Avienda appeared disappointed that he did not spit the stew out in disgust, though sometimes it was difficult to tell what she was feeling. At times, she seemed to take great pleasure in discomfiting him. Had he been trying to pretend that he was Aiel, he would have thought she was trying to prove he was not. Tired and eager for sleep, he only took off his coat and boots before crawling into his blankets and turning his back to Avienda. Aiel men and women might take sweat baths together, but a short time in Shinar,
where they did something much the same, had convinced him that he was not made for that sort of thing, not without going so red in the face that he died of it. He had tried not to listen to the rustle of her undressing beneath her own blankets. At least she had that much modesty. But he kept his back turned anyway, just in case. She claimed she was supposed to sleep there, to continue his lessons on Aiel ways and customs, since he spent so much of his days with the chiefs. They both knew that was a lie, though what the wise ones thought she could find out this way, he could not imagine. She gave little grunts every now and then as she tugged at something and muttered to herself. To cover the sounds and stop himself thinking of what they must mean, he said, "Malayne's wedding was impressive. Did Bale really know nothing about it until Malayne and Dorinda told him?" "Of course not," she replied scornfully, pausing for what he thought was a stocking coming off. "Why should he know before Malayne laid the bridal wreath at his feet and asked him?" Abruptly she laughed. "Malayne nearly drove herself and Dorinda to distraction, finding cigata blossoms for the wreath. Few grow so close to the dragon wall." "Does that mean something special? Cigata blossoms?" That was what he had sent her, the flowers she had never acknowledged. "That she has a prickly nature and means to keep it." Another pause, broken by mutters. "Had she used leaves or flowers from sweet root, it would have meant she claimed a sweet nature. Morning drop would mean she would be submissive, and there are too many to list. It would take me days to teach all the combinations to you, and you do not need to know them. You will not have an Aiel wife. You belong to Elaine." He nearly looked at her when she said submissive, a word less likely to describe any Aiel woman he could not conceive. "Probably means she gives warning before she stabs you." There had been more of a muffled sound to her voice at the end. Pulling her blouse over her head, he realized. He wished the lamps were out. No, that would have made it worse. But then he had been through this every single night since Rodion, and every single night it was worse. He had to put an end to it. The woman was going to sleep with the wise ones, where she belonged from now on. He would learn what he could from her as he could. He had thought exactly the same thing for 15 nights now. Trying to chase the pictures out of his head, he said, "That bit at the end, after the vows were said." No sooner had half a dozen wise ones pronounced their blessings than 100 of Malayne's bloodkin had rushed in to surround her, all carrying their spears. 100 of Bale's kin had rallied to him, and he had fought his way to her. No one had been veiled, of course. It was all part of custom. But blood had still been shed on both sides. A few minutes before, Malayne was vowing that she loved him, but when he reached her, she fought like a cornered ridge cat. If Dorinda had not punched her in the short ribs, he did not think Bale would ever have gotten her over his shoulder to carry off. He still has the limp and the black eye she gave him. "Should she have been a weakling?" Avienda said sleepily. He had to know the worth of her. She was not a trinket for him to put in his pouch. She yawned, and he heard her nestling deeper into her blankets. "What does teaching a man to sing mean?" Aiel men did not sing, not once they were old enough to take up a spear, except for battle chants and laments for the dead. "You are thinking of Matt Cawthon?" She actually giggled. "Sometimes a man gives up the spear for a maiden." "You're making that up." "I never heard of anything like that." "Well, it is not really giving up the spear." Her voice held a thick muzziness. "Sometimes a man desires a maiden who will not give up the spear for him, and he arranges to be taken Gaishine by her. He is a fool, of course. No maiden would look at Gaishine as he hopes. He has worked hard and kept strictly to his place, and the first thing that is done is to make him learn to sing, to entertain the spear sisters while they eat. She is going to teach him to sing. That is what maidens say when a man makes a fool of himself over one of the spear sisters." A very peculiar people. "Avienda." He had said he was not going to ask her this again. Lan said it was Kandori work, a pattern called snowflakes. Probably loot from some raid up north.
Who gave you that necklace?
A friend, Randall Thor. We came far today, and you will start us early tomorrow. Sleep well and wake, Randall Thor.
Only an Aiel would wish you a good night by hoping that you did not die in your sleep.
Setting the much smaller, if much more intricate, ward on his dreams, he channeled the lamps out and tried to sleep.
A friend. The rain came from the north. But she had had the necklace in Rudion. Why did he care?
Avienda's slow breathing seemed loud in his ears until he fell asleep, and then he dreamed a confused dream of Min and Elaine helping him throw Avienda, wearing nothing but that necklace, over his shoulder, while she beat him over the head with a wreath of cigata blossoms.
Chapter 22 Bird Calls by Night. Lying face down on his blankets with his eyes closed, Matt luxuriated in the feel of Melindra's thumbs, kneading their way down his spine. There was nothing quite as good as a massage after a long day in the saddle. Well, some things were, but right then he was willing to settle for her thumbs.
"You are well muscled for such a short man, Matrim Cawthon."
He opened one eye and glanced back at her, kneeling astride his hips. She had built up the fire twice as high as needed, and sweat trickled down her body. Her fine golden hair, close cut except for that Aiel tail at the nape of her neck, clung to her scalp.
"If I'm too short, you can always find somebody else." "You are not too short for my taste," she laughed, ruffling his hair.
It was longer than hers.
"And you are cute." "Relax. This does no good if you're tense."
Grunting, he closed his eyes again.
"Cute,
light,
and short."
Only Aiel could call him short. In every other land he had been in, he was taller than most men, if not always by much. He could remember being tall. Taller than Rand, when he rode against Arthur Hawkwing. And a hand shorter than he was now when he fought beside Maesine against the Elgari. He had spoken to Lan, claiming he had overheard some names. The warder said Maesine had been a king of Aeron, one of the 10 nations. That much Matt already knew, some 400 or 500 years before the Trolloc Wars. Lan doubted that even the Brown Aja knew more. Much had been lost in the Trolloc Wars, and more in the War of the 100 Years. Those were the earliest and latest of the memories that had been planted in his skull. Nothing after Artur Peyndreg Tanrial, and nothing before Maesine of Aeron.
"Are you cold?" Melindra said incredulously. "You shivered."
She scrambled off him, and he heard her add wood to the fire. There was enough scrub here for burning. She slapped his bottom hard as she climbed back on, murmuring,
"Good muscle."
"If you keep on like that," he muttered, "I'll think you mean to spit me for supper, like a Trolloc." It was not that he did not enjoy Melindra, as long as she refrained from pointing out that she was taller anyway. But the situation made him uncomfortable.
"No spits for you, Matrim Cawthon."
Her thumbs dug hard into his shoulder.
"That's it. Relax."
He supposed that he would marry someday, settle down. That's what you did. A woman, a house, a family, shackled to one spot for the rest of his life. I never heard of a wife yet that liked her husband having a drink or a gamble. And there was what those folk on the other side of the doorframe Tirangrial had said, that he was fated to marry the daughter of the 9 moons. A man has to marry sooner or later, I suppose. But he certainly did not mean to take an Aiel wife. He wanted to dance with as many women as he could, while he could.
"You are not made for spits, but for great honor, I think," Melindra said softly.
"Sounds fine to me." Only now he could not get another woman to look at him. Not the maidens or the others. It was as if Melindra had hung a sign on him saying, "Owned by Melindra of the Jumai Shido."
"Well,
she would not have to put that last bit on. Not here. Then again, who knew what an Aiel would do, especially a maiden of the spear? Women did not think the same as men, and Aiel women did not think like anybody else in the world.
It is strange that you efface yourself so.
Efface myself? He mumbled. Her hands did feel good. Knots were coming out that he had not known were there.
Oh.
He wondered if it had something to do with that necklace. Melindra seemed to set great store by it, or by receiving it, anyway. She never wore the thing, of course. Maidens did not.
But she carried it in her pouch and showed it to every woman who asked.
A lot of them seemed to.
You put yourself in the shadow of Randall Thor.
I am not in anybody's shadow, he said absently. It could not be the necklace. He had given jewelry to other women, maidens and others. He liked giving things to pretty women, even if all he got in return was a smile. He never expected more. If a woman did not enjoy a kiss and a cuddle as much as he did, what was the point?
Of course there is honor of a sort in being in the shadow of the Kaer Karn. To be near the mighty, you must stand in their shade.
Shade, Matt agreed, not really hearing. Sometimes the women accepted, and sometimes not, but none had decided they owned him. That was what rankled, really. He was not about to be owned by any woman, however pretty she was, and no matter how good her hands were at loosening knotted muscles.
Your scars should be scars of honor, earned in your own name as a chief, not this.
One finger traced along the hanging scar on his neck.
Did you earn this serving the Kaer Karn?
Shrugging her hand away, he pushed up on his elbows and twisted to look at her.
Are you sure Daughter of the Nine Moons doesn't mean anything to you? I have told you it does not. Lie down.
If you are lying to me, I swear I'll welt your rump. Hands on hips, she looked down at him dangerously.
Do you think you can welt my rump, Matt Cawthon?
I'll give it my best try. She would probably put a spear through his ribs.
Do you swear you've never heard of the Daughter of the Nine Moons? I never have, she said slowly. Who is she? Or what? Lie down and let me...
A blackbird called, seemingly everywhere in the tent and outside as well. And a moment later, a redwing. Good Two Rivers birds. Rand had chosen his warnings from what he knew. Birds not found in the waste. Melindra was off him in an instant, wrapping her shufa around her head, veiling herself as she snatched up spears and bucklers. She darted from the tent like that.
Blood and bloody ashes, Matt muttered as he struggled into his breeches.
A redwing meant the south. He and Melindra had put up their tent to the south, with the Chareen, as far from Rand as they could get and stay in the encampment. He was not going outside in those thorn bushes naked, the way Melindra had. The blackbird meant north, where the Sharad were camped. They were coming from two sides at once. Stamping his feet in his boots as best he could in the low tent, he looked at the silver fox head lying beside his blankets. Shouts were rising outside, the clash of metal on metal. He had finally figured out that that medallion had somehow kept Moraine from healing him on her first try. So long as he had been touching it, her channeling had not affected him. He had never heard of Shadow Spawn able to channel, but there was always the Black Aja. So Rand said, and he believed it. And always the chance that one of the Forsaken had finally come after Rand. Pulling the leather thong over his head so the medallion hung on his chest, he snatched up his raven-marked spear and ducked out into the cold moonlight. He had no time to feel the icy chill. Before he was completely out of the tent, he almost lost his head to a scythe-curved Trolloc sword. The blade brushed his hair as he threw himself into a low dive, rolling to his feet with the spear ready. At first glance in the darkness, the Trolloc might have been a bulky man, though half again as tall as any Aielman, garbed all in black mail with spikes at elbows and shoulders, and a helmet with goat's horns attached. But these horns grew out of that two-human head, and below the eyes, a goat's muzzle thrust out. Snarling, the Trolloc lunged at him and howled in a harsh language never meant for a human tongue. Matt spun his spear like a quarterstaff, knocking the heavy curved blade to one side, and thrust his long spear point into the creature's middle, mail parting for that power-made steel as easily as the flesh beneath. The goat-snotted Trolloc folded over with a harsh cry, and Matt pulled his weapon free, dodging aside as it fell. All around him, Aiel, some unclothed, or only half, but all black-veiled, fought Trollocs with tusked boar's snouts, or wolves' muzzles, or eagles' beaks, some with heads horned, or crested with feathers, wielding those oddly curved swords and spiked axes, hooked tridents and spears. Here and there, one used a huge bow to shoot barbed arrows the size of small spears. Men fought alongside the Trollocs, too, in rough coats, with swords, shouting desperately as they died among the thorn bushes.
Samael! Samael and the Golden Bees!
The Dark Friends were dying, most as soon as they engaged in Aiel, but the Trollocs died harder.
I am no bloody hero,
Matt shouted to no one in particular as he battled a Trolloc with a bear's muzzle and hairy ears, his third. The creature carried a long-handled axe with half a dozen sharp spikes and a flaring blade big enough to split a tree, throwing it about like a toy in those great hairy hands. It was being near Rand that got Matt into these things. All he wanted from life was some good wine, a game of dice, and a pretty girl or three.
I don't want to be mixed up in this!
Especially not if Samael was around.
Do you hear me?
The Trolloc went down with a ruined throat, and he found himself facing a Murdral, just as it finished killing two Aiel who had come at it together. The half-man looked like a man, pasty pale, armored in black overlapping scales like a snake's. It moved like a snake, too, boneless and fluid and quick, night-black cloak hanging still, however it darted. And it had no eyes, just a dead-white sweep of skin where eyes should be. That eyeless gaze turned on him, and he shivered, fear oozing along his bones. The look of the eyeless is fear, they said in the Borderlands, where they should know. And even Aiel admitted that a Murdral's stare sent chills through the marrow. That was the creature's first weapon. The half-men came at him in a flowing run. With a roar, Matt rushed to meet it, spear spinning like a quarterstaff, thrusting, ever moving. The thing carried a blade as dark as its cloak, a sword hammered at the forges of Thakandar, and if that cut him, he was as good as dead unless Moraine appeared quickly with her healing. But there was only one sure way to take down a Fade. All-out attack. You had to overwhelm it before it overwhelmed you. And a thought for defense could be a good way to die. He could not even spare a glance for the battle raging around him in the night. The Murdral's blade flickered like a serpent's tongue, darted like black lightning, but to counter Matt's attack. When raven-marked power-wrought steel met Thakandar-made metal, blue light flashed around them, a crackle of sheet lightning. Suddenly Matt's slashing attack struck flesh. Black sword and pale hand flew away, and the reverse stroke sliced open the Murdral's throat, but Matt did not stop. Thrust through the heart, cut to one hamstring, then the other, all in rapid succession. Only then did he step away from the thing still thrashing on the ground, flailing about with its good hand and severed stump, wounds spilling inky blood. Half-men took a long time to admit that they were dead. They did not die completely, except with a setting sun. Looking around, Matt realized that the attack was over. Whatever Dark Friends or Trollocs were not dead had fled. At least he saw none standing except Aiel. Some of them were down, too. He plucked a kerchief from the neck of a Dark Friend corpse to wipe the Murdral's black blood from his spear point. It would etch the metal if left too long. This night assault made no sense. By the bodies he could see in the moonlight, Trolloc and human, none had made it much past the first line of tents. And without far greater numbers, they could not have hoped for more.
What was that you called out? Karai something? The old tongue?
He turned to look at Melindra.
She had unveiled, but she still wore not a stitch more than her shufa. There were other maidens about, and men, wearing as little, and showing as little concern, though most did seem to be heading back to their tents without lingering. They had no modesty. That was it. No modesty at all. She did not even seem to feel the cold, though her breath made wisps of mist. He was as sweaty as she, and freezing now that he had no fight for his life to occupy his mind.
"Something I heard once," he told her. "I like the sound of it."
"Karai an Kaldazar, for the honor of the Red Eagle. The battle cry of Manetherin." Most of his memories were from Manetherin, some of those he had before the twisted doorway. Moraine said it was the old blood coming out, just as long as it did not come out of his veins. She put an arm around his shoulders as he started back toward their tent.
"I saw you with the Night Runner, Matt Coffin."
That was one of the Aiel names for Myrdral.
"You are as tall as a man needs to be."
Grinning, he slipped his arm around her waist, but he could not get the attack out of his head. He wanted to. His thoughts were too snarled in his borrowed memories, but he could not. Why had anyone launched such a hopeless assault? No one but a fool attacked overwhelming force without a reason. That was the thought he could not pry out of his head. No one attacked without a reason. The bird calls pulled Rand awake immediately, and he seized Sayadin as he tossed the blankets aside and ran out, coatless, in his stocking feet. The night was cold and moonlit, faint sounds of battle drifting up from the hills below the pass. Around him, Aiel stirred like scurrying ants, rushing into the night to where an attack might come here in the pass. The wards would signal again. Shadowspawn in the pass would cause a winterfinch to call, until he unraveled them in the morning. But there was no point in taking foolish chances. Soon the pass was still again. The Gashine in their tents, forbidden weapons even now. The other Aiel, off at the places that might need defending. Even Adeline and the other maidens had gone, as if they knew he would have held them back if they waited. He could hear a few mutters from the wagons near the town walls, but neither the drivers nor Kadir showed themselves. He did not expect them to. The faint sounds of battle, men shouting, screaming, dying, came from two directions. Both below, well away from him. People were out around the Wise One's tents, too, staring toward the fighting, it seemed. An attack down there made no sense. It was not the Miagoma, not unless Timolin had taken Shadowspawn into his clan, and that was as likely as White Cloak's recruiting Trollocs. He turned back toward his tent, and even enclosed in the void he gave a start. Avienda had come out into the moonlight, a blanket wrapped around her. Just beyond her stood a tall man shrouded in a dark cloak. Moon shadows drifted over a gaunt face that was too pale, with eyes too large. A crooning rose, and the cloak opened into wide, leathery wings like those of a bat. Moving as in a dream, Avienda drifted toward the waiting embrace. Rand channeled, and finger-thin balefire burned past her, an arrow of solid light to take the Drakkar in the head. The effect of that narrower stream was slower, but no less sure than with the Darkhounds. The creature's colors reversed, black to white, white to black, and it became sparkling motes that melted in air. Avienda shook herself as the crooning ended, stared at the last particles as they vanished, and turned to Rand, gathering the blanket closer. Her hand came up, and a stream of fire as thick as his head roared toward him. Startled, even inside the emptiness, never thinking of the power, he threw himself to the ground beneath the billowing flames. They died in an instant. "What are you doing?" he barked, so angry, so shocked, that the void cracked and Sayadin vanished from him. He scrambled to his feet, stalking toward her.
"This tops any ingratitude I ever heard of."
He was going to shake her until her teeth rattled.
"I just saved your life, in case you failed to notice. And if I offended some bloody Aiel custom, I don't give a—"
"The next time," she snapped back, "I will leave the great Ka-Karn to deal with matters by himself."
Awkwardly clutching the blanket close, she ducked stiff-backed into the tent. For the first time, he looked behind him, at another Drakkar, crumpled on the ground in flames. He had been so angry that he had not heard the crackling and popping as it burned, had not smelled the odor of burning grease. He had not even sensed the evil of it. A Drakkar killed first by sucking the soul away and then life. It had to be close, touching, but this one lay no more than 2 paces from where he had been standing. He was not certain how effective a Drakkar's crooning embrace was against someone filled with Saadin, but he was glad he had not found out. Drawing a deep breath, he knelt beside the tent flap. Avienda? He could not go in. A lamp was lit in there, and she could be sitting there, naked for all he knew, mentally ripping him up and down the way he deserved. Avienda, I'm sorry. I apologize. I was a fool to speak as I did without asking why. I should know that you wouldn't harm me, and I'm a fool, he finished weakly. A great deal you know, Randall Thor, came a muffled reply. You are a fool. How did Aiel apologize? He had never asked her that. Considering Giotto, teaching men to sing, and wedding customs, he did not think he would. Yes, I am. And I apologize. There was no answer this time. Are you in your blankets? Silence. Muttering to himself, he stood, working his stockinged toes on the icy ground. He was going to have to remain out here until he was sure she was decently covered, without boots or coat. He seized hold of Saadin, taint and all, just to be distanced from the bone-grinding cold inside the void. The 3 wise-one dreamwalkers came running, of course, and Egwene, all staring at the burning Drakkar as they skirted it, drawing their shawls around them with almost the same motion.
Only one, Amis said. I thank the light, but I am surprised.
There were 2, Rand told her. I destroyed the other.
Why should he be hesitant just because Moraine had warned him against balefire?
It was a weapon like any other. If Avienda had not killed this one, it might have gotten me.
The feel of her channeling drew us, Egwene said, looking him up and down.
At first he thought she was checking for injuries, but she paid special attention to his stocking feet, then glanced at the tent, where a crack in the tent flap showed lamplight.
You've upset her again, haven't you? She saved your life, and you...
Men! With a disgusted shake of her head, she brushed past him and into the tent. He heard faint voices, but could not make out what was being said. Malaine gave a hitch to her shawl.
If you do not need us, then we must see what is happening below.
She hurried off without waiting for the other 2. Bear cackled as she and Amis followed.
A wager on who she will check on first. My amethyst necklace, that you like so much, against that sapphire bracelet of yours?
Done. I choose Dorinda.
The older wise one cackled again.
Her eyes are still full of bale. A first sister is a first sister, but a new husband...
They moved down out of earshot, and he bent toward the tent flap. He could still not hear what they were saying, not unless he stuck his ear to the crack, and he was not about to do that. Surely Avienda had covered herself with Egwene in there. Then again, the way Egwene had taken to Aiel ways, it was just as likely she had peeled out of her clothes instead. The soft sound of slippers announced Moiraine and Lan, and Rand straightened. Though he could hear both of them breathing, the warder's steps still made barely an audible noise. Moraine's hair hung about her face, and she held a dark robe around her, the silk shining with the moon. Lan was fully dressed, booted and armed, wrapped in that cloak that made him part of the night. Of course. The clamor of fighting was dying down in the hills below.
I'm surprised you were not here sooner, Moraine.
His voice sounded cold, but better his voice than him. He held on to Saadin, fought it, and the night's icy chill remained something far off. He was aware of it, aware of each hair on his arms stirring with cold beneath his shirt sleeves, but it did not touch him. You usually come looking for me as soon as you sense trouble. I have never explained all that I do, or do not do. Her voice was as coolly mysterious as it had ever been, yet even in the moonlight Rand was certain that she was blushing. Lan looked troubled, though with him it was difficult to tell.
I cannot hold your hand forever. Eventually you must walk alone.
I did that tonight, didn't I? Embarrassment slid across the void. That sounded as though he had done everything himself, and he added, Aviendal all but took one off my back. The flames in the Drakkar were burning low.
As well she was here, then,
Moraine said calmly. You did not need me. She had not been afraid, of that he was sure. He had seen her rush into the midst of Shadowspawn, wielding the power as skillfully as Lan did his sword. Seen it too often to believe fear in her. So why had she not come when she sensed the Drakkar? She could have, and Lan as well. That was one of the gifts a warder received from the bond between him and an Aes Sedai. He could make her tell, catch her between her oath to him and her inability to lie straight out. No, he could not. Or would not. He would not do that to someone who was trying to help him. At least now we know what the attack below was about, he said. To make me think something important was happening there, while the Drakkar slipped in on me. They tried that at Cold Rock's Hold, and it did not work there either. Only maybe it almost had, this time. If that had been the intent. You would think they would try something different. Culloden ahead of him, the Forsaken everywhere, it seemed. Why could he not face one enemy at a time?
Do not make the mistake of thinking the Forsaken simple, Moraine said. That could easily be fatal.
She shifted her robe as though wishing it were thicker.
The hour is late. If you have no further need of me...
Aiel began to drift back as she and the warder left. Some exclaimed over the Drakkar, and roused some of the Gaishine to drag it away, but most simply looked at it before going to their tents. They seemed to expect such things of him now. When Adelin and the maidens appeared, their soft-booted feet dragged. They stared at the Drakkar, being hauled away by white-robed men, and exchanged long looks before approaching Rand.
There was nothing here, Adelin said slowly. The attack was all below. Dark friends and Trollocs.
Shouting Samael and the Golden Bees, I heard,
added another. With her head wrapped in a shufa, Rand could not make out who she was. She sounded young. Some of the maidens were not more than 16. Taking a deep breath, Adelin held out one of her spears, horizontally in front of him, rock steady. The others did the same, one spear each.
I failed. Adelin said. We should have been here when the Drakkar came. Instead, we ran like children to dance the spears.
What am I supposed to do with those? Rand asked, and Adelin replied without hesitation.
Whatever you wish, Kaar Karn. We stand ready and will not resist.
Rand shook his head. Bloody Aiel and their bloody Geato.
You take those and go back to guarding my tent.
Well, go!
Looks passed between them before they began to obey, as reluctantly as they had approached him in the first place.
And one of you tell Avienda that I will be coming in when I return, he added.
He was not going to spend the entire night outside, wondering whether it was safe. He stalked away, the stony ground hard under his feet.
Asmodian's tent was not very far from his. There had not been a sound out of it.
He whipped open the flap and ducked in. Asmodian was sitting in the dark, chewing his lip. He flinched when Rand appeared, and gave him no chance to speak.
You did not expect me to take a hand, did you? I felt the Drakkar, but you could deal with those. You did. I have never liked Drakkar. We should never have made them. They have fewer brains than a Trolloc. Give them an order, and they still sometimes kill whatever is closest. If I had come out... If I had done something, what if someone noticed? What if they realized it could not be you channeling?
Well for you that you didn't, Rand cut him off, sitting cross-legged in the dark. If I had felt you full of sidine out there tonight, I might have killed you. The other man's laugh was shaky.
I thought of that, too.
It was Samael who sent the attack tonight. The Trollocs and Dark Friends, anyway.
It is not like Samael to throw men away, Asmodian said slowly. But he'll see 10,000 dead, or 10 times that, if it gains him what he thinks is worth the cost. Maybe one of the others wants you to think it was him. Even if the Aiel took prisoners, Trollocs do not think of much besides killing, and Dark Friends believe what they are told.
It was him. He tried to bait me into attacking him once in the same way at Sarendahar.
Oh, light. The thought drifted across the surface of the void. I said me.
He did not know where Sarendahar had been, or anything but what he had said. The words had just come out. After a long silence, Asmodian said quietly,
I never knew that.
What I want to know is, why? Rand chose his words carefully, hoping that they were all his. He remembered Samael's face. A man.
Not mine. Not my memory.
A compact man, with a short yellow beard. Asmodian had described all the Forsaken, but he knew this image was not made from that description. Samael had always wanted to be taller, and resented it that the power could not make him so. Asmodian had never told him that. From what you've told me, he is not likely to want to face me unless he is sure of victory, and maybe not then. You said he'd likely leave me to the Dark One if he could. So why is he sure he'll win now if I decide to go after him? They discussed it in the dark for hours without coming to any conclusion. Asmodian held to the opinion that it had been one of the others hoping to send Rand against Samael, and thus get rid of one or both. At least Asmodian said that he did. Rand could feel the man's dark eyes on him, wondering. That slip had been too big to cover. When he finally returned to his own tent, Adeline and the dozen maidens all sprang to their feet, all of them at once telling him that Egwene was gone and Avienda long asleep, that she was angry with him. They both were. They gave so many different pieces of advice on handling the two women's anger, all at the same time, that he could understand none of it. Finally they fell silent, looks passing between them, and Adeline spoke alone.
"We must speak of tonight, of what we did, and what we failed to do.
It was nothing," he told her. "And if it was something, it's forgiven and forgotten. I would like to have a few hours' sleep for once. If you want to discuss it, go talk to Amis or Bear. I am sure they'll understand what you're after more than I do." That shut them up, surprisingly, and let him get inside. Avienda was in her blankets, with one slim, bare leg sticking out. He tried not to look at it, or her. She had left a lamp lit. He climbed into his own blankets gratefully, and channeled the lamp out before releasing Saidine. This time he dreamed of Avienda hurling fire, only she was not hurling it at a Drakkar, and Samael was sitting at her side, laughing.
Chapter 23. The Fifth, I Give You. Raining mist around on a grassy hilltop, Egwene watched the streams of Aiel coming down from the Jangai Pass. The saddle had pushed her skirts above her knees again, but she hardly noticed that now. She could not spend every minute fussing with them, and she had on stockings. It was not as though she were bare-legged. In trotting columns, the Aiel flowed by below her, arranged by clan and sept and society. Thousands upon thousands with their pack horses and mules, the Gai Shine who would tend the camps while the rest fought, spreading a mile wide and more still in the pass or already out of sight ahead. Even without families, it seemed a nation on the march. The silk path had been a road here, a full 50 paces wide and paved with broad white stones, slicing straight through hills carved to make a level. Only occasionally was it visible through the mass of Aiel, although they seemed to prefer running on the grass, but many of the paving stones had lifted up at a corner or sunk down at one end. More than 20 years had gone by since this road had carried more than local farmers' carts and a handful of wagons. It was startling to see trees again, real trees, towering oaks and leatherleaf in actual thickets, rather than an occasional wind-twisted, stunted shape, and tall grass waving in the breeze across the hills. There was real forest to the north, and clouds in the sky, thin and high, yet clouds. The air seemed blessedly cool after the waste, and moist, though brown leaves and large brown swaths through the grass told her that in reality it might be hotter and drier than usual for the time of year. Still, the countryside of Kyrian was a lush paradise compared to the other side of the Dragon Wall. A small stream meandered north beneath a nearly flat bridge, bordered by the dried clay of a broader bed. The river Galen lay not too many miles away in that direction. She wondered what the Aiel would make of that river. She had seen Aiel near a river once before. The shrunken band of water marked a definite break in the steady flow of people, as men and maidens paused to stare in amazement before leaping across. Kader's wagons rumbled by on the road, the long mule teams working hard but still losing ground to the Aiel. It had taken 4 days to traverse the twists and turns of the pass, and Rand apparently intended to go as far into Kyrian as he could in the few hours of daylight remaining. Moiraine and Lan rode with the wagons, not ahead of them, or even with Kader's box-like little white house on wheels, but alongside the second wagon, where the canvas-covered shape of the door-frame Turangrial made a hump above the rest of the load. Some of the load was wrapped carefully, or packed in boxes or barrels that Kader had brought into the waste full of his goods, and some was simply stuck in wherever it would fit. Odd shapes of metal and glass, a red crystal chair, 2 child-sized statues of a nude man and woman, rods of bone and ivory and strange black materials in varying lengths and thicknesses, all sorts of things, including some Egwene could hardly begin to describe. Moiraine had used every inch of space in all of the wagons. Egwene wished that she knew why the Aes Sedai was so concerned with that particular wagon. Perhaps no one else had noticed that Moiraine paid it more attention than all the others combined, but she had. Not that she was likely to find out any time soon. Her newfound equality with Moiraine was a tender thing, as she had learned when she asked that question in the heart of the pass, and was told that her imagination was too vivid, and if she had time to spy on the Aes Sedai, perhaps Moiraine should speak to the Wise Ones about intensifying her training. She had apologized profusely, of course, and the soft words seemed to have worked. Amis and the others were not taking any more of her nights than they had before. 100 or so Tardad Fardar Asmai went trotting by on her side of the road, moving easily, veils hanging but ready to be donned, full quivers at hips. Some carried their curved horn bows, arrows nocked, while others had their bows cased on their backs, spears and bucklers swinging rhythmically as they ran. At their rear, a dozen Gaishine in their white robes leading pack mules struggled to keep up. One wore black, not white. Isendre labored hardest of all. Egwene could pick Adelin out, and 2 or 3 others who had been guarding Rand's tent the night of the attack. Each clutched a doll in addition to her weapons, a rough-made doll clothed in full skirts and white blouse. They looked even more stone-faced than usual, trying to pretend that they held no such thing. She was not sure what that was about. The maidens who stood that guard had come in a group to see Bear and Amis when their stint was done, and had spent a long time with them. The next morning, while camp was still breaking in the grayness before dawn, they had begun making those dolls. She had not been able to ask, of course, but she had commented on it to one, a red-haired Tomanel of the Sarai Sept named Myra, and the woman said it was to remind her that she was not a child. Her tone made it clear that she did not want to talk, One of the maidens carrying a doll was no more than 16, yet Myra was at least as old as Adeline. It made little sense, and that was frustrating. Every time Egwene thought she understood Aiel ways, something demonstrated that she did not. Despite herself, her eyes were drawn back to the mouth of the pass. The row of stakes was still there, just visible, stretching from steep mountain slope to steep mountain slope, except where Aiel had kicked some of them down. Kuladin had left another message. Men and women impaled across their path, standing there 7 days dead. The tall gray walls of Selene clung to the hills at the right of the pass, nothing showing above them. Moiraine said it had held only a shadow of its one-time glory, yet it had still been a considerable town, much larger than Tyen. No more remained of it, however. No survivors either, except whoever the Shido had carried off, although here some had probably run for places they thought safe. There had been farms on these hills. Most of eastern Kyrian had been abandoned after the Aiel War, but a town needed farms for food. Now soot-streaked chimneys thrust up from blackened stone farmhouse walls. Here a few charred rafters remained above a stone barn. There barn and farmhouse had collapsed from the heat. The hill where she sat missed saddle had been sheep pasture. Near the fence at the foot of the hill, flies still buzzed over the refuse of butchering. Not an animal remained in any pasture, not a chicken scratching in a barnyard. The crop fields were burned stubble. Kuladin and the Shido were Aiel, but so were Avienda, and Bear, and Amis, and Milane, and Ruark, who said she reminded him of one of his daughters. They had been disgusted at the impalements, yet even they seemed to think it little more than the tree killers deserved. Perhaps the only way to truly know the Aiel was to be born Aiel. Casting a last glance at the destroyed town, she rode slowly down to the rough stone fence and let herself out at the gate, leaning down to refasten the rawhide thong out of habit. The irony was that Moiraine had said that Selene might actually go over to Kuladin. In the shifting currents of Desdemar, in balancing an Aiel invader against a man who had sent Tyrens into Kyrian for whatever reason, the decision could have tipped either way had Kuladin given them a chance to choose. She rode along the broad road until she caught up with Rand, in his red coat today, and joined Avienda and Amis, and 30 or more wise ones she barely knew besides the other two dreamwalkers, all following at a short distance. Matt, with his hat and his black hafted spear, and Jason Natale, leather-cased harp slung on his back, and crimson banner rippling in the breeze, were riding, but hurrying Aiel passed the party by on both sides, because Rand led his dapple stallion, talking with the clan chiefs. Skirts or no skirts, the wise ones would have made a good job of keeping up with the passing columns if they were not sticking to Rand like pine sap. They barely glanced at Egwene, their eyes and ears focused on him and the six chiefs. "And whoever comes through after Timolan," Rand was saying in a firm voice, "has to be told the same thing." Stone dogs left to watch at Tyen had returned to report the Mayagoma entering the pass a day behind. "I've come to stop Kuladin despoiling this land, not to loot it." "A hard message," Bale said, "for us as well, if you mean we cannot take the fifth." Han and the rest, even Ruark, nodded. "The fifth I give you." Rand did not raise his voice, yet suddenly his words were driven nails. "But no part of that is to be food. We will live on what can be found wild or hunted or bought, if there is anyone with food to sell, until I can have the Tyrans increase what they're bringing up from Tyr. If any man takes a penny more than the fifth, or a loaf of bread without payment, if he burns so much as a hut because it belongs to a tree killer, or kills a man who is not trying to kill him, that man will I hang, whoever he is." "Dark to tell the clans this," Diarik said, almost as stony. "I came to follow he who comes with the dawn, not to coddle oath-breakers." Bale and Jiron opened their mouths as if to agree, but each saw the other and snapped his teeth shut again. "Mark what I said, Diarik," Rand said. "I came to save this land, not ruin it further. What I say stands for every clan, including the Mayagoma, and any more who follow. Every clan. You mark me well." This time no one spoke, and he swung back into Giaidin's saddle, letting the stallion walk on among the chiefs. Those Aiel faces showed no expression. Egwene drew breath. Those men were all old enough to be his father and more, leaders of their people as surely as kings for all they disclaimed it, hardened leaders in battle. It seemed only yesterday that he had been a boy in more than age, a youth who asked and hoped, rather than commanded and expected to be obeyed. He was changing faster than she could keep up with now. A good thing if he kept these men from doing to other cities what Cooladin had done to Tyan and Salian. She told herself that. She only wished he could do it without showing more arrogance every day. How soon before he expected her to obey him as Moiraine did? Or all Aes Sedai? She hoped it was only arrogance. Wanting to talk, she kicked a foot free of its stirrup and held a hand down for Avienda, but the Aiel woman shook her head. She really did not like to ride. And maybe all those wise ones striding in a pack made her reluctant, too. Some of them would not have ridden had both their legs been broken. With a sigh, Egwene climbed down, leading Mist by the reins, settling her skirts a little grumpily. The soft, knee-high Aiel boots she wore looked comfortable and were, but not for walking very far on that hard, uneven pavement. "He truly is in command," she said. Avienda barely shifted her eyes from Rand's back. "I do not know him. I cannot know him. Look at the thing he carries." She meant the sword, of course. Rand did not precisely carry it. It hung at the pommel of his saddle in a plain scabbard of brown boar hide, the long hilt covered in the same leather, rising as high as his waist. He had had hilt and scabbard made by a man from Tyan on the journey through the pass. Egwene wondered why, when he could channel a sword of fire and do other things that made swords seem toys. "You did give it to him, Avienda." Her friend scowled. "He tries to make me accept the hilt, too. He used it. It is his. Used it in front of me as if to mock me with a sword in his hand." "You are not angry about the sword." She did not think Avienda was. She had not said a word about it that night in Rand's tent. "You are still upset over how he spoke to you, and I do understand. I know he is sorry. He sometimes speaks without thinking, but if you would only let him apologize..." "I do not want his apologies," Avienda muttered. "I do not want... I can bear this no more. I cannot sleep in his tent any longer." Suddenly she took Egwene's arm, and if Egwene had not known better, she would have thought her on the brink of tears. "You must speak to them for me. To Amis and Bear and Merlane. They will listen to you. You are Aes Sedai. They must let me return to their tents. They must." "Who must do what?" Cerulea said, dropping back from the others to walk alongside them. The wise one of Shenda Hold had thin white hair and a face like leather drawn tight over her skull, and clear green eyes that could knock a horse down at 10 paces. That was the way she normally looked at anyone. When Cerulea was angry, other wise ones sat quietly, and clan chiefs made excuses to leave. Milane and another wise one, a graying black water Nakai, started to join them too, until Cerulea turned those eyes on them. "If you were not so busy thinking of that new husband, Milane, you would know Amis wants to talk with you. You also, Aaron." Milane flushed bright red and scurried back to the others, but the older woman got there first. Cerulea watched them go, then put her full attention on Avienda. "Now we can have a quiet talk. So you do not want to do something. Something you were told to do, of course. And you think this child Aes Sedai can get you out of doing it." "Cerulea, I..." Avienda got no further.
In my day, girls jumped when a wise one said jump, and continued jumping until they were told to stop. As I am still alive, it is still my day. Need I make myself clearer? Avienda took a deep breath. No, Cerilia, she said meekly. The old woman's eyes came to rest on Egwene. And you? Do you think you are going to beg her off? No, Cerilia. Egwene felt as though she should curtsy. Good, Cerilia said, not sounding satisfied, just as if it was what she had expected. It almost certainly was. Now I can speak to you of what I really want to know. I hear the Karakarn has given you an interest gift like no other ever heard of. Rubies and moondrops. Avienda jumped as if a mouse had run up her leg. Well, she probably would not, but it was the way Egwene would have jumped in that circumstance. The Aiel explained about Layman's sword and the scabbard so hastily that her words tripped over one another. Cerilia shifted her shawl, muttering about girls touching swords even wrapped in blankets, and about having a sharp word with young bear. So he has not captured your eye. A pity. It would bind him to us. He sees too many people as his now. For a moment she eyed Avienda up and down. I will have Farron look at you. His great father is my sister's son. You have other duties to the people than learning to be a wise one. Those hips were made for babes. Avienda stumbled over an upraised paving stone and just caught herself short of falling. I will think on him when there is time, she said breathlessly. I have much to learn yet of being a wise one, and Farron is Sayadun, and the Black Eyes have vowed not to sleep beneath roof or tent until Cooladin is dead. Cooladin was Sayadun. The leathery-faced wise one nodded as though everything had been settled. You, young Aes Sedai, you know the Karakarn well, it is said. Will he do as he has threatened? Hang even a clan chief? I think, maybe, that he will. More quickly, Egwene added, but I am sure he can be brought to see reason. She was not sure of any such thing, or even that it was reason. What he had said sounded only just, but justice would do him no good if he found the others turning against him as well as the Shido. Cerilia glanced at her in surprise, then turned to gaze on the chiefs around Rand's horse that should have knocked the lot of them flat. You mistake me. He must show that mangy pack of wolves that he is the chief wolf. A chief must be harder than other men, young Aes Sedai, and the Karakarn harder than other chiefs. Every day a few more men and even maidens are taken by the bleakness, but they are the soft outer bark of the ironwood. What remains is the hard inner core, and he must be hard to lead them. Egwene noticed that she did not include herself or the other wise ones among those who would be led. Muttering to herself about mangy wolves, Cerilia strode ahead, and soon had all the wise ones listening as they walked. Whatever she was saying, it did not carry. "Who is this Farron?" Egwene asked. "I've never heard you speak of him. What does he look like?" Frowning at Cerilia's back, more than half hidden by the women clustered around her, Avienda spoke absently. "He looks much like Ruark, only younger, taller, and more handsome, with much redder hair. For over a year he has been trying to attract Inila's interest, but I think she will teach him to sing before she gives up the spear." "I don't understand. Do you mean to share him with Inila?" It still felt odd, speaking so casually of that. Avienda stumbled again and stared at her. "Share him? I want no part of him. His face is beautiful, but he laughs like a braying mule and picks at his ears." "But from the way you talked to Cerilia, I thought you liked him. Why didn't you tell her what you just told me?" The other woman's low laugh sounded pained. "Egwene, if she thought I was trying to balk in this, she would make the bridal wreath herself and drag both Farron and me by the neck to be wed. Have you ever seen anyone say no to Cerilia? Could you?" Egwene opened her mouth to say that of course she could, and promptly closed it again.
Making Nynaeve step back was one thing, and trying the same with Cyrillia quite another. It would be like standing in the path of a landslide and telling it to stop. To change the subject, she said, "I will speak to Amish and the others for you." Not that she really thought it would do much good now. The right time had been before it began. At least Avienda saw the impropriety of the situation finally. Perhaps, if we go to them together, I am sure they will listen. No, Egwene, I must obey the wise ones. Jito requires it. Just as if she had not been asking for intercession a moment earlier, just as if she had not all but begged the wise ones not to make her sleep in Rand's tent. But why is my duty to the people never what I wish? Why must it be what I would rather die before doing? Avienda, no one is going to make you marry or have babies. Not even Cyrillia. Egwene wished she had sounded a bit less limp on that last. You do not understand, the other woman said softly, and I cannot explain it to you. She gathered her shawl around her and would not speak of it further. She was willing to discuss their lessons, or whether Cooladin would turn and give battle, or how marriage had affected Milane, who seemed to have to work at being prickly now, or anything at all, except what it was that she could not or would not explain. Chapter 24. A Message Sent. The land changed as the sun began to sink. The hills grew lower, the thickets larger. Often the toppled stone fences of what had been fields had become mounds sprouting wild hedges, or ran through long stands of oak and leatherleaf and hickory, pine and paper bark and trees Egwene did not know. The few farmhouses had no roofs, and trees 10 or 15 paces high grew in them here, little woods enclosed inside the stone walls, complete with twittering birds and black-tailed squirrels. The occasional rivulet caused as much talk among the Aiel as the small forests did, and the grass. They had heard tales of the wetlands, read of them in books bought from merchants and peddlers like Hadnan Kader, but few had actually seen them since the hunt for Laemon. They adapted quickly, though. The grey-brown of the tents blended well with dead leaves under the trees and with the dying grass and weeds. The camp spread over miles, marked by thousands of small cook-fires in the golden dusk. Egwene was more than happy to crawl into her tent once the Guy Shine had it up. Inside, the lamps were lit and a small fire burned in the fire pit. Unlacing her soft boots, she tugged them off and her woolen stockings as well, and sprawled on the bright-layered rugs, wriggling her toes. She wished she had a basin of water to soak her feet. She could not pretend to be as hardy as the Aiel, but she was growing soft, if a few hours of walking made her feet feel twice their size. Of course, water would be no problem here, or it should not be. She remembered that shrunken stream. But surely she could even have a proper bath again. Coinda, meek and silent in her white robes, brought her supper, some of that pale flat bread made from Zemai flour, and in a red-striped bowl, a thick stew that she ate mechanically, though she felt more tired than hungry. She recognized the dried peppers and beans, but did not ask what the dark meat was. Rabbit, she told herself firmly, and hoped that it was. The Aiel ate things that would put more curl in her hair than Elaine had. She was willing to bet that Rand could not even look at what he was eating. Men were always picky eaters. Once done with the stew, she stretched out near an ornately worked silver lamp that had a polished silver disc to reflect and increase its light. She had felt a little guilty once she realized that most of the Aiel had no light at night but their fires. Few had brought lamps or oil except the wise ones and the chiefs of clans and septs. But there was no point to sitting in the dim illumination of the fire pit when she could have proper light. That reminded her. The nights here would not be so drastic a contrast with the days as in the waste. The tent was already beginning to feel uncomfortably warm. She channeled briefly flows of air to smother the fire, and dug into her saddlebags for the worn leather-bound book that she had borrowed from Avienda. It was a small, fat volume with crowded lines of small print, hard to read except in good light, but easily portable. The Flame, the Blade, and the Heart, it was called, a collection of tales about Birgitta and Gidel Cain, Anselan and Baruchel, Rogosh Eagle-Eye and Dunsinin, and a dozen more. Avienda claimed that she liked it for the adventures and battles, and maybe she did, but every last story told of the love of a man and a woman, too. Egwene was willing to admit that that was what she liked, the sometimes stormy, sometimes tender threads of undying love. To herself, she would admit it anyway. It was hardly the sort of enjoyment a woman with any pretensions to sense at all could confess publicly. In truth, she did not feel like reading any more than she had felt like eating. All she really wanted to do was bathe and sleep, and she might be willing to forego bathing. But tonight she and Amis were to meet Nynaeve in Tel Iron Riod. It would not be night yet wherever Nynaeve was on her way to Gildon, and that meant remaining awake. Elaine had made the menagerie sound quite exciting at their last meeting, though Egwene hardly thought that Galad's presence was reason enough to go herring off like that. Nynaeve and Elaine had simply grown to like adventure, in her opinion. It was too bad about Suan. They needed a firm hand to settle them down. Odd that she should think of Nynaeve so. Nynaeve had always been the one with the firm hand. But since that episode in the Tower of Tel Iron Riod, Nynaeve had become less and less someone she had to struggle against. Guiltily, she realized, as she turned a page, that she was looking forward to seeing Nynaeve tonight. Not because Nynaeve was a friend, but because she wanted to see if the effects had lingered. If Nynaeve tugged at her braid, she would arch a cool eyebrow at her and, "Light, I hope it's held. If she lets out about that jaunt, Amis and Bear and Milane will take turns skinning me if they don't just tell me to go." Her eyes kept trying to drift shut as she read, fuzzily half-dreaming the stories in the book. She could be as strong as any of these women, as strong and brave as Dunsinin or Narain or Melisinde or even Birgitta, as strong as Avienda. Would Nynaeve have sense enough to hold her tongue in front of Amis tonight? She had a vague thought of taking Nynaeve by the scruff of the neck and shaking her. Silly. Nynaeve was years the older. Arch an eyebrow at her. Dunsinin, Birgitta, as hardy and strong as a maiden of the spear. Her head slipped down to the pages, and she tried to cradle the small book under her cheek as her breathing slowed and deepened. She gave a start at finding herself among the great red stone columns of the Heart of the Stone in the strange light of Tel Iron Riod, and another at realizing that she wore the Cadin Sore. Amis would not be pleased to see her in that, not amused at all. Hastily she changed it, and was surprised when her clothes flickered back and forth between the Algoda blouse and bulky wool skirt and a fine gown of brocaded blue silk before finally settling on the Aiel garb, complete with her ivory bracelet of flames and her gold and ivory necklace. That indecision had not happened to her in some time. For a moment she thought of stepping out of the world of dreams, but she suspected she was soundly asleep, back in her tent. Very likely she would only step into a dream of her own, and she did not yet always have awareness in her dreams. Without that she could not return to Tel Iron Riod. She was not about to leave Amis and Nynaeve alone together. Who knew what Nynaeve would say if Amis got her temper up? When the Wise One arrived, she would simply say that she had just arrived herself. The Wise Ones had always been a bit ahead of her, or arrived at the same time before this, but surely if Amis believed she had only been there a second, it would not matter. She had almost grown accustomed to the feel of unseen eyes in this vast chamber, only the columns and the shadows and all this empty space. Still, she hoped that Amis was not too long in coming, nor Nynaeve, but they would be. Time could be as strange in Tel Iron Riod as in any dream, but it had to be a good hour yet before the arranged meeting. Perhaps she had time to... Suddenly she realized that she could hear voices, like faint whispers among the columns. Embracing Saidar, she moved cautiously toward the sound, toward the place where Rand had left Kalandor beneath the great dome. The wise ones claimed that control of Tel Iranriod was as strong as the One Power here, but she knew her abilities with the power far better, and trusted them more. Still hidden well back among the thick redstone columns, she stopped and stared. It was not a pair of black sisters, as she had feared, and not Nynaeve either. Instead, Elaine stood near the glittering shaft of Kalandor rising out of the floorstone, deep in quiet conversation with as oddly dressed a woman as Egwene had ever seen. She wore a short white coat of peculiar cut, and wide yellow trousers gathered in folds at her ankles, above short boots with raised heels. An intricate braid of golden hair hung down her back, and she held a bow that gleamed like polished silver. The arrows in the quiver shone, too. Egwene squeezed her eyes shut. First the difficulty with her dress, and now this. Just because she had been reading about Birgitta, a silver bow told the name for certain, was no reason to imagine that she saw her. Birgitta waited, somewhere, for the Horn of Valir to call her and the other heroes to the last battle. But when Egwene opened her eyes again, Elaine and the oddly dressed woman were still there. She could not quite make out what they were saying, but she believed her eyes this time. She was on the point of going out to announce herself when a voice spoke behind her. "Did you decide to come early? Alone?" Egwene whirled to face Amys, her sun-darkened face too youthful for her white hair, and leathery-cheeked bare. Both stood with their arms folded beneath their breasts. Even the way their shawls were pulled tight spoke of displeasure. "I fell asleep," Egwene said. It was too much before time for her story to work. Even as she explained hastily about dozing off and why she had not gone back, minus the part about not wanting Nynaeve and Amys to talk alone, she was surprised to feel a tinge of shame that she had intended to lie, and relief that she had not. Not that the truth would necessarily save her. Amys was not as strict as Bear, not quite, but she was perfectly capable of setting her to piling up rocks the rest of the night. Many of the wise ones were great believers in useless labor for punishment. You could not tell yourself you were doing anything other than being punished while you were burying ashes with a spoon. That was provided they did not simply refuse to teach her any more, of course. The ashes would be much preferable. She could not hold back a sigh of relief when Amys nodded and said, "It can happen. But next time return and dream your own dreams. I could have heard what Nynaeve has to say and tell her what we know. If Milane was not with Bale and Dorinda tonight, she would be here as well. You frightened Bear. She is proud of your progress, and if anything happened to you..." Bear did not look proud. If anything, she scowled even more deeply as Amys paused. "You are lucky Coinda found you when she returned to clear away your supper, and was worried when she could not rouse you to move to your blankets. If I thought you had been here more than a few minutes alone..." The glare sharpened in dire promise for a moment, and then her voice turned grumpy. "Now I suppose we have to wait for Nynaeve to arrive, just to stop you begging if we send you back. If we must, we must, but we will use the time to advantage. Concentrate your mind on..." "It isn't Nynaeve," Egwene said hastily. She did not want to know what a lesson would be like with Bear in this mood. "It is Elaine, and..." She trailed off as she turned. Elaine, in elegant green silk suitable for a ball, was pacing up and down not far from Kalandor. Birgitta was nowhere to be seen. "I did not imagine her." "She is here already," Amys said, moving to where she could see too. "Another young fool," Bear muttered. "Girls today have no more brains or discipline than goats." She stalked out ahead of Egwene and Amys and planted herself across Kalandor's glittering shape from Elaine, fists on hips. "You are not my pupil, Elaine of Andor, though you've wheedled enough out of us to keep you from killing yourself here if you are careful. But if you were, I would welt you from the toes up and send you back to your mother until you were grown enough to be let out of her sight, which I think might take as many more years as you have lived already. I know you have been coming into the world of dreams alone, you and Nynaeve. You are both fools to do it." Elaine gave a start when they first appeared, but as Bear's tirade washed over her, she drew herself up, that chilly tilt to her chin. Her gown became red and took on a finer sheen, and grew embroidery down the sleeves and across the high bodice, including rearing lions in white and gold lilies, her own sigil. A thin golden diadem rested in her red-gold curls, a single rearing lion set in moondrops above her brows. She did not yet have the best control over such things. Then again, maybe she wore exactly what she intended this time. "I do thank you for your concern," she said regally. "Yet it is true that I am not your pupil.